God saved a boy like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. Was blind, but now I see. 'Twas grace that took my heart to sing, and grace my soul free. If I should live ten thousand years, thy shining as the star, I would need more days to
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, June 20th, 2016. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you're listening over another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 605-562-3140, and our participant code is 385698. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. And we'll try to answer them, you know, here this evening. Also, please support our business partners. You can find our banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support National Liberty Alliance's effort to save America. Also, please support National Liberty Alliance by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab up on the top right. Okay, tonight's scripture reading is Romans 12, verses 1 through 21. So that's Romans 12, verses 1 through 21. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service. And be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. For I say, through the grace given unto me, to every man that is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly, according as God hath dealt to every man the measure of faith. For as we have many members in one body, and all members have not the same office, so we being many are one body in Christ, and every one members one of another. Having then gifts differing according to the grace that is given to us, whether prophecy, let us prophesy according to the proportion of faith, or ministry, let us wait on ministering, or he that teacheth on teaching, or he that exhorteth on exhortation. He that giveth, let him do it with simplicity. He that ruleth with diligence, he that showeth mercy with cheerfulness. Let love be without dissimulation. Abhor that which is evil. Cleave to that which is good. Be kindly affectionate one to another with brotherly love, in honor preferring one another. Not slothful in business, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord, rejoicing in hope, patient in tribulation, continuing instant in prayer, distributing to the necessities of the saints, given to hospitality. Bless them which persecute you. Bless and curse not. Rejoice with them that do rejoice, and weep with them that weep. Be of the same mind, one toward another. Mind not high things, but condescend to men of low estates. Be not wise in your own conceit. Recompense to no man evil for evil. Provide things honest in the sight of all men. If it be possible, as much as lieth in you, live peacefully with all men. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath, for it is written, vengeance is mine, I will pay, saith the Lord. I will repay, saith the Lord. Therefore, if thine enemy hunger, feed him. If he thirst, give him drink. For in so doing, thou shalt heap coals of fire on his head. Be not overcome of evil, but overcome evil with good. That was Romans chapter 12, verses 1 through 21. Okay, tonight we're going to talk a little bit about, one of the first things I want to talk about is the Committee of Safety. We had a pretty good meeting, I think, last Thursday. For those who have missed it, you can go over to our page on the Committee of Safety and click on that, and you can listen to the audio that we recorded last Thursday. I certainly hope more people start to show up at those Thursday's meetings. Those are the times when we're preparing to really organize across the nation. And if we expect to win back our nation, to succeed in our efforts, then we surely do have to organize. So please organize, come together with us on Thursday nights. We try to keep it down to an hour, but the most of the important stuff is definitely handled within the first hour, but we'll do better with that. Okay, tonight's topic, I'm going to be talking about the Committee of Safety. George Washington, concerning the Committee of Safety, warned us concerning political parties and private organizations and associations. And I'm going to read just a couple of paragraphs out of his farewell speech that he gave after 8 years in office. And I want you to understand that we'd come to realize this only a few weeks ago, that the Committee of Safety morphed into what we call today the Committeemen. And anybody who doesn't know what the Committeemen is, that is one of the most powerful offices in our nation. It is the most powerful office in the nation. That is where we the people get to consent to our government. But we'll talk about the problems and what happened with that. But George Washington said in his farewell speech, all obstructions to the execution of the laws, all combinations and associations under whatever plausible character with the real design to direct, to control, to counteract, to or the regular deliberation and action of the constitutional authorities are destructive of this fundamental principle and of a fatal tendency. They serve to organize faction, to give it an artificial and extraordinary force, to put into place of the delegated will of the nation the will of a party, often a small but artful and enterprising minority of the community, and according to the alternate triumphs of different parties, to make the public administration the mirror of the ill-concerted and incongruous projects of faction, rather than the organ of consistent and wholesome plans digested by common councils and modified by mutual interests. However, combinations or associations of the above description may now and then answer popular ends. They are likely, in the course of time and things, to become a potent engines by which cunning, ambitious, and unprincipled men will be enabled to subvert the power of the people and to usurp for themselves the reins of government, destroying afterwards the very engines which have lifted them up to unjust dominions. Now, it's important for people to realize that these engines that God, that he is speaking about, George Washington is speaking about, destroying afterward the very engines which have lifted them up to unjust dominions. That was the Committee of Safety. And the process by which they usurped and the reins of government that they have taken control of, they've taken it away from the committeemen. And again, the Committees of Safety morphed in to the committee, to committeeman. Hang on. Someone's trying to get me on the phone. I don't know why. I think I'm coming through. Let me just double check to make sure. I am coming in, am I not? Someone maybe hit star six. Let me know. Am I being heard here? Testing 1, 2.
Yes,
I hear you.
Loud and clear.
Okay. All right.
Clear.
Fine. Thank you. Okay. Let me get back into the mute. Okay, thank you. All right, these engines were the very committeemen who were called the Committee of Safety and morphed into the committeemen that we have today. Now, to understand the power and the authority of the committeeman, it is indeed the power and the authority of the two political parties that control this country that have been usurped and taken and stolen by the powers that be, if I may. No one becomes, well, and very rarely, you know, there are always exceptions to every rule because there are ways to get around certain things. But generally speaking, no one gets into office without their approval. They don't care. The people who control these things control both parties. They control the Democrats and they control the Republicans. And they really don't care who gets into office, whether it's the criminal on the left or the criminal on the right, as they understand it. It doesn't matter to them because their agenda still comes forward. There's a Republican agenda, there's a Democrat agenda, and both of those agendas are here to serve the elite, to serve the New World Order, to serve those people who are behind our government and control the strings. This is the power that they have robbed from the people. What the parties have done is it's a top-down structure, and they've taken over the complete committeeman process. Committeemen today are not elected. They're appointed. They're appointed by the party leadership, and it starts from the national level down to the state level and right down into the county level and into the local level, and so they control all of that. Nobody gets into office without coming through the committeeman. And the power of the committeeman is such, if we, the people, had the total control back of the committeeman process, where it's a bottom-up process, where the power is in the people and not being orchestrated by someone on top pulling the strings, if we, the people, had that power, a very small committee of 2, 3, 4, 5 people, half a dozen people, could walk into the sheriff's office, any sheriff within their county, and explain to him how he or she is not doing their job, or how maybe that they're allowing the federal agencies to come in here and to do things to people, arrest them or charge them, serve them without due process. And we would be able to tell the sheriff that, hey, you can't allow this to happen. And the sheriff would immediately obey. He would immediately believe once you lay out the process and immediately respond. Why? Because that's the power of the party. That's the power of the committee man. Now, what they've done is they robbed this whole process. The very engine that again, was this committee of safety or the committee man that morphed into that committee man, that is the power. In New York, and I'm sure many, many other places, but we know in New York election law, there was a law on the books until 1909. It was the last time it was seen on the books. And it was instilled there in the very beginning, okay? And it supported or said exactly what Washington was talking about. And it was called subsection 21 in 1909, New York election law, where it said that no organization or association of citizens for the election of city, town, or village offices, that's the town committeeman, shall be deemed a political party. In other words, the political party cannot become an organization. It cannot become an association. A political party is a political process. And we have a lot to learn about that. We have been teaching this years ago. We put this aside because we were working with the judicial process when we found United States versus Williams, and we decided to move over to try to straighten out the problems on a judicial level, because only then can we get the necessary justice and the obedience of law on the political level, because we took this into the courts. And we found that the courts were corrupt, and we found that they were all in on this, and there was no way to go up against the parties. You could not win against these parties in any court in the land, nowhere, not possible. We tried, and we were realizing it was an uphill battle. We understood the only way we could do it is to build the committee man process one by one, and we were just focusing in on New York, and that was a daunting task. I forget how many committeemen there are in New York. I don't remember the numbers. I think it was something like 19,000, maybe somewhere around there, close to the number of cities and towns in the whole United States. And I think the entire nation, I don't remember the numbers, so I'm not going to say, but it's quite a few. But here's how it basically works. The committeemen come together and they decide who that they would support for the purpose of a primary election. The whole process was to be created for primary elections first, to find as many good individuals that we would believe were statesmen, that would be honest, people who were constitutionalists, people who would support the Constitution when they raised their hand and swore to obey and defend the Constitution, really meant it. And we could hold their feet to the fire if they didn't. But this is what the committeemen were supposed to be doing. Let's start off with the Committee of Safety. The Committee of Safety created the whole process and took us through that 10-year period or so of creating a new nation, which brought us to the point where we have finally had a constitution. Of course, we started off with the Declaration of Independence and ended up with the Constitution. And 2-3 years later, we ended up with the Bill of Rights. That was all the work of the Committee of Safety. And the Committee of Safety, these people that organized across the whole nation, they had two people minimum from each community, okay? All of society, each community had a minimum of two people that belonged to this Committee of Safety. And these committees of safety in each colony came together and formed the necessary structures, just like we have today, to bring together law and order, to bring together a government. They tried to work out with Britain and to salvage that relationship that we had with Britain back then. And this whole thing started really, at least the safeties of committees started to surface in 1760. okay? And it was 1776, so it's 16 years later, where they found that they just could not work the problem out with the existing British government, sort of like a federal government to the colonies. They just couldn't work these things out. They refused to obey. They refused to respond. They refused to give us common law. And it ended up where the local communities, who the people who are truly in power, that they started to make a move and go another direction. And they formed, of course, the Declaration of Independence. They agreed upon that, and they went forward. Of course, we fought the war, and some 10 years later, we ended up with a constitution. We have no intentions of doing anything like that. We already have, the war has already been fought and already been won. The Constitution has already been constructed. The Bill of Rights have already been laid forth. And everything there, the process of law, the three branches of government, the structure is all in place. It's in place at every level, from the village to the town to the city to the county and to the state and to the United States. It's been there for 200 years. The problem is that ugly corporatism has overlaid itself upon every I'll call it a trust, a common law trust, a government. But I would not look at it as a corporation, of course not, because that's what they created. They incorporated everything. They created it into a business-type form where people actually have an ownership to it. And that's a whole other story also. But the bottom line is they just overlaid this fiction over reality. So our reality is still there. The only thing that's going to take it back is when we hit critical mass, continuing to become educated, to understand the process and procedures of the courts, to understand our Constitution, the Bill of Rights, that our rights are unalienable, to understand due process, which is the main focus of all law. If you don't have due process, you have nothing. You can have as many Bill of Rights, any rights to the Bill of Rights that you want. We have 10, and of course we have much more than that, but you can list 100 of them. And if you don't have the right of due process, you don't have any of them. And that's where we're at today. They refuse us due process. They refuse to give us our day in court. They refuse to allow us to face our accusers. They refuse to swear or bring these people in to make the sworn statements that convict people in courts today. It just doesn't happen. And then, of course, they put all these statutes out there and call them law. But in any event, okay, this whole structure is still there. So the Committee of Safety, when they finished, they didn't just disappear and go home and say it's all over with. They continued. They morphed into the committeemen. They were called committeemen all the way back in the very beginning when they structured this whole thing. They were called committeemen, and they continued to be called committeemen after that they have stopped and desist. On going forward with the committees of safety because it was no longer necessary. So they ceased doing those things and then moved into the controlling of who's going to get into office. And that's the power and the authority that these people who have taken control of this process, turned it into private associations, and have a monopoly on all of the politicians, all of the individual servants that are elected. They have a monopoly on all of them. And they, because they own them, so to speak, they're supported by them, they have to obey them, therefore they serve the corporation and not the people. We need to take that back. And, of course, we can't really take that back until we get to the other side. And when we say the other side, we mean the other side of common law. When we get over into the courts of common law. Gerard, you got to mute your mic. Just came in and you got a hum going in here. So we've got to get on to that other side of common law. And once we get over there to the common law and the other side of the courts, then we can enforce the Committee of Safety. But we've always been speaking about organizing. We've organized across the United States. We've organized in every state. We're pushing down into every county. And this is the perfect way to organize, especially with people in the liberty groups. They understand this stuff very quickly, very, very quickly. They understand the Committee of Safety. I have found once you explain it to people, they're on board, they want in. And when you lay out the process, especially to people here in New York that understand the committee man process, you lay it out to them, they really understand it. So we're actually, by building committees of safety, for the sole purpose of bringing a unity between the people and the government, not to go up against them, but to befriend them. And the key purpose that we're pushing forward, really, is the chain of command. If we can agree on the chain of command, and I've mentioned this, I think, last week or maybe the week before, if we can agree on the chain of command that in a national emergency, that the sheriffs run the show within each county, that they are the responsible administration of the county, they are there to keep law and order, they are there to make sure that the Constitution prevails through this process. That's their job. And if we can bring them to understanding that, and we can get the local governments to understand that, then it's a no-brainer that in a national emergency, we the people will depend upon ourselves. We will be able to get through the emergency, through the process. We will turn to the sheriff as the chief administrator of the county and chief law enforcer. And whatever protocols he sets up for all police enforcement within his county would be underneath his wing and under his control. And whatever protocols he put forth, they'd need to obey. We need to secure the fact that common law remains and that habeas corpus continues and trial by jury continues even during these hard times. And the only way we can do this is by organizing, getting Committee of Safety. I have committed in New York here that I am going to not until I rest. I'm not going to rest until we can get county committees of safety in every county in New York. And I am partnershiping with as many people as I can. And I'm going to get out my projector and my computer and my computer screen, and I'm going to travel the state on weekends until I get this job done and get others to do the same thing. And when we get all 62 counties with committees of safety, then I can rest, then I can feel safe, then I can know. Because then these committees of safety are making relationships with their local governments, befriending them, working things out with the sheriff, bringing understanding and education to these people, showing them the power and the authority of the sheriff. We've written a 36 or 38 page paper on the power and the authority of the sheriff. We still haven't gotten the video out. We want to do something short, and I need to get back to that. A few people that are looking at that, but hopefully in the next couple of weeks we'll get that video out there. But this is where we'll have security. If New York does this, and New York is able to befriend and educate all of the local powers, then the New World Order, along with its the nations, bringing all of these foreign troops, okay? All of this brought together doesn't have a chance against we the people. We could survive against them. But that's also going to require every state to do the same. And I put the challenge out to our last meeting on Thursday, and hopefully everyone that's hearing this message today, either live or through the Memorex, so to speak, you're going to come to our next Thursday night meeting and participate and take a pledge. We had 16 states pledge to work relentlessly. 16 people, individuals in each of the states. I believe it was number 16. I have to go back and look at my notes, but I think it was 16 states. Pledged to work, people who pledged in those states to work day and night until they get it done, or whatever time they could put into this, of course, to develop committees of safety in their entire states. And this week, I'd like to get another 16. And the next week, another 16. Until we get all 50 states working relentlessly on this project, partnershiping with people within their state to organize the committees of safeties for the sole purpose of protecting the people, setting forth the necessary protocol for the chain of command that is constitutional a constitutional chain of command. This is nothing being just created out of the thin air. This is our Constitution. This is our common law. This is the responsibility of we the people. This is what we have to do. So we need to get out there and build these committees of safety. And then these committees of safety will also train them in the committee man process. And we'll start the process. Look, once we can organize New York State, we're going to organize those individuals and show them how it doesn't matter what time of the year it is. If it's done in August or if it's done in September or October or November, it matters not to us. Because whenever it's done, we're going to go through the emergency process of electing the committeemen. They don't have to, the powers that be, they don't have to acknowledge it. We don't care if they acknowledge it or not. But we'll bring it through a process of election, through petitions within our own election districts. And we will file it with them. And if they refuse to receive them, then we'll send them through file through certified mail. They could do whatever they want with them. As a matter of fact, we'll bring them together. I'll figure out a plan on how we can bring them all together if they refuse them. But we will get them filed. And they can ignore them. They could do what they want with them. But when we get to the other side, we would then have established an entire group of people across the nation as committeemen. Okay, so we will teach everyone how to do that. That's what we originally had started. Again, we worked for quite a few years on this in New York, and until we discovered that the blockage was coming right from the state itself, that the commissioners for the Board of Election and both parties were stopping any elected committeeman from taking election. So once we could teach the people how to get elected into that process, then on the other side of things, then we have total control, because then the committeeman will come up and take control of the entire political process, literally overnight, just like if we get the common law into the federal courts, it'll literally take it over overnight. And, of course, all we have to do is require these individuals in office to obey the law, to be obedient to the law, that's all they have to do, and we can require them through the threat of losing their job from the point of view of the committeemen, or the threat of being indicted from the point of view of doing criminal actions by breaking the law, okay, then these people will obey. And if they obey and behave and obey the Constitution, we just solved every single problem that we have. Within reason, of course. We'll always have some problems. But we pretty much solved most of the problems of the nation. They take care of itself. How? Through the obedience of law. It's that simple. It doesn't get any more complicated than that. If an agency is unconstitutional, it becomes null and void, doesn't it? If that agency becomes null and void, all legislation written concerning the control and the operations and the statutes of controlling that agency is irrelevant, disappears, doesn't it? It's very simple. It's a very simple concept, and it's just very simple to really do. But only the people can save America. We, the people, have got to step up. We've got to do our duty. Everybody in this room, we have got to stop thinking, the other guy will do it. Forget about it. The other guy isn't doing it. We need you. And we need you today. We need you now. And woe is you if you shirk your duties. When we, the people, understand the consequences of shirking our constitutional duties as we, the people, as the militia, as the consentors of government, if we shirk our duties, then woe is us. We deserve everything we get. So forget laziness. And we're not asking anyone to quit their job and to work 24/7 on this. We're asking everybody to give to the process, give back to our nation, to bring our country back under the control, to give every moment you can afford to give. Very soon, I will be traveling the state every weekend. Saturday or Sunday, I might even go out during the week in the evenings. I used to do it in evenings often, too. But once a week, I'm going to start traveling the state once a week to a new county to get this thing going. And if I can get 10 people doing the same thing I've got, in 6 weeks, we can get the whole state done. 10 people, 6 weeks, we're done. I've already got 4 or 5 people willing and ready and able to travel to do what has to be done. And once we show them once how simple it is, they can duplicate what we have and go off, and 6 of us, 10 of us can go off and do the same thing. You have to do this in your own states. You have to organize also. So please, let's make this Thursday meeting for the purpose of organizing the nation, for the purpose of getting forward, moving forward, a commitment on the committees of safety that will we will then train when a state becomes solidified. We will then train the people on how to become committeemen and to become elected committeemen. And then you'll sit in your position and wait until critical mass is met. And as a matter of fact, just think about this. If we're able to work through the process in every county, in other words, just in one state alone, that's critical mass in that state. If we were to work getting committees of safety in every county in America, that's 3,134 counties. That's critical mass on a national level. This can be achieved in 3 months, but only if you want it to be. Only if you will give the necessary time to make it happen. Only the people can save America. The question becomes, will you? All right, I'd like to move over to habeas corpus. We've been working on the habeas corpus. All the habeas corpus that have been filed, they've been taken all the way through the process as far as we can take them. Some of them may still be effective as time goes on. Some of them may not become effective until we get onto the other side. But it's in place. And when we get onto the other side, at least you'll be able to move quickly because the process is done. Let my people go. Let them out of jail. Give us our children back. Get out of our lives. Leave us alone. So we're going to continue back on this process because it's very important. We've set up a new page. It hasn't been perfectly automated yet, but you can go under help and you can click on track habeas corpuses. And when you go down there, you'll find all the habeas corpuses that we filed and all of the processes we've got to. They've been served. The affidavit has been put in place. They've been served. The default has come and gone. We've served under default. They've ignored us. We've served under contempt of court. And out of that process, 2 people have been released from jail. Now, actually, I believe there's 3. I believe there's someone in Massachusetts who was supposed to get information on that. We've kind of lost contact with that because I know Linda was dealing with that, and she's not with us. But maybe Gerard knows. But we're going to try to find out who it was that in Massachusetts was released from jail, and we had done the habeas corpus for it. Okay, so that should be 3, all right? Now, we're also going to return back to dealing with, to the best we can, with the foreclosures. You can go to help and highlight help and come down, track mortgage foreclosure papers. Now, we've done, I think, about 18 or 20 of them. Goodness, it looks like more than that. It looks like about 20 of them. So we've done about 20 foreclosure papers, which is really notification to certain individuals, particularly to the court itself that's involved. I'm not sure whether I have to double check to see if we notified the Attorney General, but if we haven't been notifying him, we're going to notify him also from this point forward of this particular crime that is being perpetrated upon we the people. They're stealing our homes. So anyway, it's a process of really just sending it in a formal way to the papers, so in a formal way as an information, okay, and sending it to the court, sending it to the sheriff, and sending it also to the mortgage company and to the individuals who are auctioning it off, which is usually connected with the mortgage companies. They're all compliant in this. They're all partners. They got the whole thing monopolized. But anyway, the process is first sending that first letter with the first affidavit. Now, nobody has gone to the second part of this. The second part is a second affidavit, which the people are supposed to, 1 week after receiving the paperwork, to call the sheriff to see if he's going to obey the law, see if they can communicate with him, see if they're going to protect them. Because if the sheriff protects them from a foreclosure that has not gone through due process, and the sheriff says, nope, not going to happen, not in my town, cease and desist. Okay? First of all, they can't take the property without the sheriff, but they have connived a plan, which we explained in the paperwork, and we should post the paperwork up. If we haven't, we'll post one up so people can read to see their sneaky plan on how they get around all this stuff. But once the sheriff goes and informs the mortgage company, go get your due process or get out of town. And he goes to the auction people and says, go to the mortgage company and make sure they got the due process or get out of town. Okay? And so even the people who have lost their homes, if the sheriff doesn't cooperate the first time around, then we do a second affidavit, and then we do a more stronger letter, almost with a threat. Not necessarily a threat, but he's in contempt of court ultimately. He's in contempt, and we're going to let him know he's breaking the law, and we've got another letter to go out to follow up after that. And then we would call up the sheriff to just ask him one question. You've got our papers. We've communicated with you. We only have one question for you. Are you going to obey the law or not? That's all we want to know. And silence, okay, is fraud if he refuses to talk. But nevertheless, that's as far as we could take it at that point. I think the second time around may really start to push the sheriff to take it serious. But some of these sheriffs, unfortunately, are involved with this whole evil process. They're making money, they're being paid off, there's drugs going on, child prostitution, all kinds of stuff. Most of us with National Liberty Alliance knows about all this stuff. And they're involved in the same corruption as the rest of them. But not all of them. I think most of them are not. That's my impression. Most of them are not. But they are ignorant. And ignorance, prevents people from doing the right thing, to execute the laws, which is what they're responsible for. If they're ignorant to those laws, how can they execute them? So they have to learn, they have to understand. And that's where we, the people, come in. That's why the committees of safety is so important. And that's why the committee men are so important. So, but anyway, that's the process. So we need to get back onto that process. We're going to be sending out emails to all of these people that started the process to let them know where they're at with this. Well, they can come up here and look right now. But if they want us to continue, then they got to get us the affidavit, the second affidavit. So we'll talk about that. I'll talk about that through emails with the people involved with that. We're going to start the habeas corpuses taking intakes. Now, anybody going back over to the other page, go to help and click on track habeas corpus petitions. If you click on that, okay, this is all we have. We got all the files from Linda about a week and a half ago. I started working through them. It was just way too overwhelming for me. I mean, I'd be frozen up for a month trying to go through all that stuff and put it together. So I passed it on to two other individuals who worked on it, been working on it for about 5 or 6 days or so, and they've come to the same conclusion. Well, we'll continue on it, but it's a struggle. The way the information was collected, the different things we don't, a lot of them don't, even though they were listed in files as being complete and ready to go, most of them didn't have signed affidavits in those files, and some of them still had lacking information in the intake. So we're kind of back down to square one. Anybody from this point forward that wants this habeas corpus to go through or anything with the mortgage, they need to go to intake and fill out a paper. Now, if you go to the help, highlight the help, and click on help with abuse of courts, at the bottom of that page would be where you would find these intake forms, one for habeas corpuses and one for mortgages. We've made this completely simple. Now, these two forms that are up here right now, I'm redoing them, so I should disconnect them, but I'll disconnect them right after the meeting. I almost have the other two done, and I think I'm going to get them done tonight before I get to sleep, and I'll get them up there. I definitely have the habeas corpus one tonight back up there. I ran out of time, and the meeting started, so I had to stop working on that. But I'll get that up there. Those two forms are very, very simple, and I'll give you for an example. Let me open up the petition form. One for the petition. Is it for the petition? Let's see. Yeah, that's the petition itself. Mortgage, habeas. Okay, I'm going to have to open one up straight to... Let me go into my file and open one up. Okay, this is the intake form. And this is how simple it is. It's all done on one page. And the information we need is simply this. The petitioner's name, the next friend's name, the court of origin, the prosecuting attorney, the state attorney general, the county sheriff or the U.S. Marshal if it's a federal case. If someone's imprisoned, we need to know the prison they're in. If it's a CPS case or an APS, we need to know the agency. So a prison, CPS, or APS if it's an agency that has taken a child or taken our parents. And that's it. There's nothing more. So there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 pieces of information. Everybody knows their own name. They can fill out the petitioner. The best next friend doing it, they know their own name and the friend name of the petitioner, so they can fill that out. Obviously, people know the court they're going to. So this is very simple. It's very simple. Call the court. Who's the prosecuting attorney? We go online and we even tell you, Google state attorney general, and you'll get the state attorney general. Same thing with the county sheriff. Go to Google and county, put in your county sheriff in your state, and you'll find the sheriff. Obviously, we know if someone's in prison and what prison they're in, and if CPS or APS, they know who the agency is. Everybody has that information. It's simple information. We were collecting so much information. I mean, it was just way, way overboard. And even the most important information is missing on some of these papers. So, I mean, but there's, you know, we're looking at birthdays of things and people and just more and more information. It really was way, way overboard. So we've simplified it completely, you know, tremendously. We've simplified it. So please, anybody who wants to get their intake in and going, starting tomorrow morning, you go up here. Don't do it tonight. Because if you do it on this form that's up here right now, it's a little longer than this, and it's not as laid out as the way we'd really like it. And we've just completed it tonight. So tomorrow, you can go up and pull down the form. Just take the information off your old intake. You should be able to transfer most of the information right over. You should easily be able to do it in a day, get an intake, and then it'll be put up on board. As soon as we get that intake, we will put it right up immediately, that person's information. And then the next step is the affidavit. We ask for a donation. Now, we were asking $60. We do have a money crunch, a serious money crunch. We're more than a month behind in our bills now. It makes me nervous when you think, you know, you're not going to pay the bill maybe to stay online, to keep things going, or to keep the website up, or whatever. We got bills to pay. But what we will do is people who send in money, and so let me go back to the amount. We're asking $60, okay, as a donation. And people, there are some people who couldn't afford the $60, and maybe they give us, $30 or $20 or $10 or $5 or no dollars. We didn't care because we're going to do it no matter what, okay? So people can start sending this in, and with their affidavit, we're asking them now to send $75 because we need the money. We survive on donations, and if we don't get the donations, then we're not going to survive, and we're not going to stay open to be continuing to do what we're doing. This whole operation is really supported by a very small handful of people. We've asked everybody to give $5 a month or more. And believe me, we got thousands of members, and we only get a couple of hundred people giving. That's it. And most of those people are giving $5. So it really, you know, then there are some people who give more, 20, 50, 100. I think 100 a month. And we have some others that give a little more from time to time. But of course, regular, you know, just someone will give us a donation. Sometimes we'll get a donation for 1,000 or 500. And that what gives us the push, you know, to really get over. But anyway, we think $75 is reasonable for going doing the paperwork, and that helps to support also National Liberty Alliance because there's extra money in there, and it also helps to support people who can't afford to pay anything to get the paperwork done. So that's why we think that that's a reasonable number. So we ask for $75, but you give what you can. If you can only give $60, fine. If you can only give $30, fine. But when they send the affidavit in, we expect them to give a donation. If they don't give a donation in with their affidavit, then we'll presume they can't afford it, and we'll go through the process anyway. We'll move it through. And we trust, and that's worked pretty good. Now, the people we were doing the mortgage things for, which are only halfway through, none of those people, to my knowledge, none of them has given a donation with that paperwork. So anybody that has done that process, maybe they can give us a, well, they should send us their affidavit, their second affidavit that they had met with the sheriff, and the sheriff is not willing to comply, and he's going to continue to break the law instead of protect the law. When you do that affidavit of whatever took place and you get it back to us, that's when you can send us, a donation. And again, if you don't have the money, we'll do it anyway. But then we'll go through that second letter process, and that'll put them in position as far as we can go till we hit critical mass, but at least it's ready. Bear in mind, you can still go chase. Once they take your home away from you, if they accomplish that, when we get to the other side, you go back to the sheriff and all these people, they're going to be held responsible. For every injury, there must be a remedy. They're going to have to give you your home back. They're going to have to figure something out. So that's on the other side of things. But let's do what we can on this side of things. Okay, another thing. We also started, we do not charge anybody a fee or membership fee. Membership is completely free. We don't charge for any of our courses. We don't charge for any. We've done a lot of research, a lot of papers. We've written booklets and stuff on how to access the court, and we've even written the jurist handbook for a handbook for judges, jurists, and sheriffs, and so on, which we were selling little booklets. But you can get that booklet for free. You can download it. So everything we have done was for free. It has been free from day one, and will always remain free, because we have to educate the people. We just trust that the money will come in. So everything is free. We do not charge a membership. We don't want people not to get involved. Okay. We also have the courses, and we don't charge a fee to take the course. It's free. But what we did decide to do, some people were asking for certificates of completion of these courses. So we put together a really nice certificate of completion. And anybody who has completed any of the two courses would like to get a certificate of completion. We're asking for a $20 donation for that, $20 or more for that certificate of completion. And so if you go to free courses, highlight free courses, NationalLibertyAlliance.org. Come down. It's the first one on top, certificate of completion. Okay. And you can see pretty much what the certificate looks like. Okay. And this is what you're seeing here on the page seems to be a little dull. It's much brighter than this. And on a very good quality paper. But we're charging $20 for the documents. People don't need the documents. They've got proof of they've taken the course if they're administrators. The proof of that is on our website. So when you become an administrator, you can prove you took the course just by checking out the roles and see who completed the course and who didn't. Only the people that have taken the courses can see that, by the way. Those are private pages for members that have taken the course only. But if you want a certificate of completion, send us a donation of $20 or more, and we will send you a copy of the certificate on whichever course you want. So for each course, it's $20. And again, this is really to help National Liberty Alliance get supported, because we're in desperate need of money. And so anyway, support us, because if we go away, there's nobody else out there. We're the only really active group, as active as any other group. We're the most active national group out there. And we definitely, to my understanding, are the only group that has a solution to save America and a real plan. And we're moving forward and get closer and closer day by day. So, let's support what we're doing here. Okay. Again, on the habeas corpuses and the mortgage, I'm going to get an email out. I'm going to try to get that out tomorrow so that everybody will understand where we're at, what's going on, and I'll kind of reiterate some of the things I said today in that. Gary, is Gary here? Do we have any questions? Anybody send in any questions? I saw Gary before. Is he in here, Jan, or did he have to leave?
I haven't seen his console up, and he might be up on cell phone. If so, he probably can't read the the question.
Okay, I thought I saw him a little while ago. Matter of fact, I know I saw him a little while ago. So I know he has to leave early because he wakes up early, so I don't know. We're almost 10 o'clock right now. All right, you don't have any questions, right? You haven't been receiving any questions. Okay, so they'll pile up.
I haven't received any.
Maybe next week. Let's talk with Gary about that, and if he can't make it, let's make sure he passes them to you so you can read them and we can answer them on Mondays. Yeah, okay?
Sure.
Okay, so let's see what's next. Gerard, do you have anything to add before we go over to Brent? Gerard? Star 6 to unmute.
I saw him earlier.
I'm here. Can you hear me?
We can hear you now.
Yeah, no, I'm good for now.
Okay.
Bring on Brent.
All right, we'll pass it over to you in a short while. We're going to go over to Brent. Brent, you've got the mic. Brent is the author of Excellence in the Common Law, and his website is commonlawyer.com. And he's with us, and he's going to teach us something tonight. I'm not sure whether he's going to continue on the militia, but whatever it is, you got the mic, Brent. Brent, you got to unmute yourself. I'll unmute you. I think I see you. So it's *6 to unmute yourself. Well, why don't you do it so you know how to do it? *6, and you should unmute yourself that way.
Some people have trouble making *6 work. If you find him, you might click him.
All right, let me click him then. Brent, I think you can unmute.
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, go right ahead. You got the mic. Thank you.
Well, this idea about critical mass, this is Brent, by the way, and this idea about critical mass, I'll relate a little experience that I had when I was a teenager that makes the point all anybody needs in this world trying to get something done is critical mass. It's not a majority. It's not an overwhelming mass, just a critical mass. There was a fellow back in the 60s who lived out in Iowa, I believe, and he started an organization called the NFO, the National Farmers Organization. And it was organized by counties throughout the Midwest, but reaching also then further than that to both coasts. And when I was a teenager, my father was secretary of the county organization. And the idea of National Farmers Organization was that 10% of any particular commodity, if just 10% of it could be controlled, then that would control that entire national production of that commodity, whether it be milk or meat or poultry or beef, chickens, meat, that kind of meat, or pork, eggs even, just 10%. And so the push was put on at different times to withhold 10% of the production of, for example, eggs. And all the National Farmers Organization wanted was an audience with the Secretary of Agriculture, but he wouldn't give them an audience. Well, finally, they had enough steam up that they could control and withhold 10% of, for example, the eggs. Well, by doing so, they controlled the entire market. 10%, the way they had it figured, and they penciled it out on paper, and I wasn't savvy enough at the time to know what equations they used, but that was the equation that produced the Secretary of Agriculture making a call to the National Farmers Organization, and they got a hearing, and things began to move a little bit. Well, that's the way it is also when it comes to government. I don't like to use the word politics. Politics, by definition, is the city, polis. And it is the evil ways and the devices of the city. We don't want to reshape government. We just want to replace it with the truth. Because the only thing that will overcome lawlessness, and that's what we have in mass now, a critical mass of lawlessness, the only thing that will overcome that is law, true law, from the true lawgiver. And we've been going through the four militia clauses of the United States Constitution, and I believe we've gone through three of them, and we're ready to start in on the fourth. The first militia clause of our Constitution, there are four of them, The first one charges the Congress of the United States with providing the rules for the separate states for calling forth the militia, or any part of it, when called into the service of the United States, I'm quoting the Constitution, for three reasons: to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions, and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States. That's Congress's job. They've ignored their job for well over 175 years. They've said nothing about it. Well, the second militia clause reserves to the states. The first militia clause gives a job to Congress. The second militia clause of our Constitution reserves to the states, respectively, and I'm quoting, the appointment of officers and the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress. That's the second militia clause. The third militia clause of our Constitution gives the President of the United States authority over any member of a state's militia only when called into actual service of the United States. And the governors of each state and the President have concurrent jurisdiction over the militia of any particular state, depending upon who calls the militia of that state into service first, whether it be the president or whether it be the governor of that state. Whoever calls them first, or any part of them, has jurisdiction over them. That's the doctrine of our militia clauses as respect the president and the governor. Well, that's the three classes of people: Congress, the state legislature, and governor. Then third, the president, that's the third class of people. And then the fourth militia clause and the last militia clause is the foundation militia clause, and it is different, fundamentally different than the other three. The other three militia clauses, respecting the president, the states, and the Congress, those three militia clauses, one of them reserves power to the states, that's the second militia clause. It just reserves the power, doesn't give it to the federal government. The first and third militia clauses grant power to the president and to Congress. The fourth militia clause does none of those things. It doesn't grant anything. It simply recognizes the right of the militia, that is the people, those two phrases are synonymous, to keep and bear arms, loaded guns, to carry a loaded weapon, a military-grade weapon, by the way. And this Second Amendment, this Fourth Militia Clause, forbids any act of government or any act of anyone that interferes with this individual right. By the way, there is no other kind of right but an individual right. Anything that interferes with an individual's right to keep and carry a gun is against the law in America, against the law. Any infringement, that's what our Constitution says. And it's my job to pass along what in these little conferences to pass along what the Constitution says. And somebody may say, well, that's just your opinion, or that's just the way you understand it. Well, I'll say what President Jackson said, and it applies to every American, and it applies also to the ones that have taken an oath to support and defend the Constitution. He said this. He said, when I took an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States, I did not take an oath to support and defend it as some other person understands it. I took an oath to support and defend it as I understand it, and that's what I'm doing. And it's clear, though, to me, some things are obscure in legal writing. Some things admit of weak language, ambiguous language. And we don't have that in the Second Amendment. It's clear as crystal. Our Constitution, the Second Amendment, bars infringement. What is infringement? It's anything that nibbles around the edges. Anything that may whittle something off and a little shaven at a time. Background checks, license, concealed carry permits, all of those things are clearly, unambiguously, infringements, as that word was understood when the Constitution was drafted, and as it is understood now. And those things, therefore, regardless of the pronouncement of any bureaucrat or any bureaucratic-minded judge, are unconstitutional. And it's the duty of every person to determine for themselves what is constitutional and what isn't. And you must be diligent at doing so, That means you must study. You must think about it. You must ruminate it. You must read it first. You must read it over and over again and come to your conclusion. I want to quote somebody here. I think I've quoted him before, but if I haven't, it bears quoting again. The only reason anybody has for taking your gun away, says Neil Smith, is to make you weaker than he is, so that he can do something to you that you would not allow him to do if you were equipped to prevent it. Important words to keep in mind. Our Constitution forbids any act that interferes with this individual right, as we had said, and simply put, Amendment 2 bars the national government or any state government from interfering, that means infringement, with any one of the people's non-delegable right, which is a duty to keep and carry loaded guns. If our Second Amendment stands for anything, it stands for this simple proposition, and that is this: security and freedom at the same time are possible only as each militiaman of each state fulfills his duty in accord with our Constitution's 4 militia clauses. Security and freedom at the same time are possible only through acting upon these 4 militia clauses. You can have, you can't even have security. The government will promise you security if you will give up your guns. They will not deliver it. I recall back in the 90s, it was a big promotion. The man sitting in the White House was named Clinton, and he campaigned and propagated the idea that he would put 100,000 new police officers on the streets with federal money. 100,000. It never, ever happened. And if it had happened, it would not have provided security. It would have provided more police brutality. That's what it would have done, and we see it now, even as we speak. And people say, well, not all cops are that way. Well, maybe they aren't. But certainly, the police state in America is a culture that has engulfed law enforcement. And if there are exceptions, it only makes the point. And I'm sure there have to be, but it only makes the point that, by and large, the police state is upon us. We jail more people in America, as proof of that, we jail more people in America per capita than any country in the world, including communist China and North Korea. Well, in the event that Congress neglects our Constitution's mandate to provide rules for training the militia of the several states, as indeed our Congress has neglected its duty at that point, our Constitution requires each state to organize, arm, and discipline and train its own militia. That's the first militia clause relating to Congress. The second militia clause relates to the states. Both of them, of course, have ignored that duty, neglected it. Well, in the event both Congress and the several states neglect our Constitution's mandates to them in the first 2 militia clauses, then the people of the United States, the people, that means the militia, that refers specifically, according to the words of our Constitution, to all able-bodied to carry a weapon in battle. The people, these other classes, congressmen, state government and governors and the presidents, if they have neglected their duties under the Constitution respecting the militia clauses, the people, that is the militia, must never neglect their constitutional required right to keep themselves forearmed and skilled in the use of arms. To be sure, if the people, that is the militia, fail to fulfill this fundamental duty, the national government will gain an absolute monopoly of violent force and power, and will evermore both dominate the states and oppress the people, as is now seen. In all events, our Constitution assigns none of these tasks of our 4 militia clauses to any Army, Navy, and National Guard, which is constitutionally unknown, and least of all to any police force or bureaucratic agency. Our Constitution does none of that. And the readiness of the militia of the several states is the supreme law of the land. It is the way. It is the way, the course that is to be followed to give us both security and freedom simultaneously. That means at the same time. And if the militia of the several states does not remain ever ready, the criminal law industry's police state thugs will further swell into the void, as is now seen. Americans continue to ignore the common law first principles of our Constitution's militia clauses at great peril to their freedom. Of that, there is no question. Let me get more particular about the second militia clauses, if I may. Or the fourth militia clause, the last one, called the Second Amendment. The fourth militia clause of the Second Amendment, the foundation clause of the other three militia clauses. Of our Constitution's four militia clauses, this fourth clause depends not on our Constitution for what it affirms. No, it depends upon our common law, which, of course, informs every word of this short, well-drafted clause. It says this, let me read it. A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. This clause assumes the necessity of a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. You see it there, security and freedom. That's the only way to get it. That's the point of this militia, or this fourth militia clause, called the Second Amendment. The point is, security and freedom are only possible by the militia of the several states, not by any police force, not by any armed forces, standing army, navy, air force, marine, no. And so is the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Let's parse that out a little bit, or at least try to get started. Our militia of the several states lies at the foundation of our common law freedoms and comprise the strong cords woven into the fabric of our Constitution, limiting our government. But at the foundation of our militia of the several states is the Second Amendment. It is the foundation. Simply put, the stability and strength of our Constitution depends upon the Second Amendment. And the life of our Second Amendment depends upon its clause, which states, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Infringement is the great danger. Infringement, which, if tolerated, will eat away at the Second Amendment. So held Justice Joseph Story. He said, if that happens, it will end our freedoms. He said that about 39 years after the ratification of our Constitution in his well-known commentaries on the Constitution of the United States. And indeed, the militia of our Second Amendment recognizes, as a subset of the people, according to our Supreme Court, in the Heller case, the year 2008. And those establishing and ordaining our Constitution are the people. It is the militia. The militia can't be gotten rid of. If you jailed every member of the militia of any particular state, you still haven't gotten rid of the militia. Because the militia is the people that are able-bodied to bear arms, whether they're armed or not, whether or not that right, that duty has been infringed. They're still there. Those folks still make up the militia. Without the people exercising their right according to this Second Amendment, which is the fourth militia clause, it is impossible for the Congress, the states, and the President to fulfill their duties, the militia clauses of our Constitution demand. The militia clauses of our Constitution demands. I want to say a word about the word right. it says the right of the people to keep and bear arms. And we call it the Bill of Rights. What are rights? That word has been hackneyed. It's been overused. It's been bantered about, thrown around like cordwood, until it really just has a pretty sound and it pops in people's minds like a balloon. It leaves a pleasant sound, but it's empty. If you ask people to really tell you what a right is, the answers would be over all over the lot. I know I've tried. What is a right? It's always best to go back to the etymology of the word and then see if that comports with its history, of its use. That doesn't always, but in this case it does. Right is an old Anglo-Saxon and Jute word. Jute, that means the Danes, the Vikings. It's an old word. It's a Germanic word, even a Scandinavian word. And it's still used in Germany today. They spell it R-I-C-H-T in different ways, but it's pronounced Reich. That became famous during World War II. That Hitler said that Germany was the Third Reich. What does that mean? Well, it's a very important word in the Germanic tongues, and it means duty. The Third Reich is the third duty. That was false, of course, probably, but the point I'm making is the word does have a meaning, and it's part of our language. It's a Germanic root, and it signifies responsibility under the law. The Germans have other words that mean what our word right has come to mean. It's come to indicate something selfish. Well, these are my rights, and I want them. Well, why do you want them? Well, because that's what I want. Well, that's not a reason. The reason that rights are important is because they give me a duty. What is your duty? You have a duty over your tongue. That's the First Amendment, freedom of speech. The Second Amendment, you have a duty to protect your own body and the bodies of your family, to provide for them and protect them best you can, given the circumstances. I know it gets pretty tough. I've raised a family myself. It's real tough. But then you have a duty also to protect those that you can protect in your own neighborhood, if they can't protect themselves, or if they refuse to, that's something else. But these are duties. Rights are duties. And rights, we call them fundamental, the ones in the Bill of Rights. Why do we call them fundamental? We call these fundamental rights because they have been delegated direct from the Creator to the individual. Nobody in between. There was no redelegation. You know, there are those kind of duties that are delegated from one person to another. That's not the case. That's not the case with fundamental rights. We call them fundamental because those that drafted the Constitution and those that have any sensibility to truth understand that the Creator delegated them to the individual upon creation of the individual. And because God delegated them, we say the government cannot reach them. The government has no power to even infringe. Anyone who would hamper, infringe, as it says in the Second Amendment, make it difficult for you to do your duty that God gave you, is evil. That's the point of a fundamental right. Now, there are other things that are delegated. For example, the people delegated power of the Constitution. The Constitution is delegated, then redelegated power to the Congress, and then the Constitution says the Congress then, that after they've been delegated that power, they have the power to delegate power to federal courts besides the Supreme Court. That's a redelegation of power. That's not a fundamental right. That's something different, very much different. We're talking here, though, about a fundamental right. That's one that comes straight from God. And anybody get between you and your duty, the duty God has given you, is lawless. And that's why this word infringe here is used. Any government attempt, state or federal, to infringe upon this fundamental individual right to keep and carry a loaded weapon, in the case here, anybody who would do that strikes at the foundation of the only way possible to have freedom and security at the same time. That's evil. Anybody who would infringe upon the right of the individual to keep and bear arms, any part of the government that would do that, is striking at the foundation of the only way possible to have freedom and security at the same time. Says that right in the Second Amendment, and they're right. The government will provide or will promise security in exchange for freedom, and then you'll get neither. They'll give you neither. That's why this is so important. Now, militia, the word militia is the Latin word, the old common law word, FYRD, F-Y-R-D. Today, we might say Fred or Frederick, but this is FYRD, F-Y-R-D. That's their word for the militia. Again, an old Germanic word, an Anglo-Saxon word, signifying, the militia signifies the able-bodied males of the people. Every man able to carry his weapon. Further, the common law required each militiaman to stay at all times, watch this word, regular. That's why it says, well, regulated. That's the root. That's from the root regular. We'll talk about that, what that means. It's an important word. It's found in other places in our Constitution. And it means the same thing every time it's used. They must stay regular, self-armed. That means self-armed. Regular means self-armed, self-disciplined, to safe and skilled use of his weapon. Keeping his weapon always within reach, whether at home or away, enabling quick muster in readiness to fight. Hence, the colonial militiamen at Concord were called Minute Men. That's why they called them Minutemen, because they were regular. You hear sailors, American sailors, have always talked about, they boast, they're the regular Navy, they're not the reserves, there's a difference. And regular Navy, what's regular about the regular Navy? Why do they call themselves the regular Navy and boast in it? They call themselves the regular Navy because they're ever ready, always ready. I had a brother, that's the meaning of the word regular. I had a brother, no, I still have a brother, but he was in Desert Storm back in 1990, and he was about to retire. And got called into action, and he went to a meeting of the chiefs of staff. He was in London at the time of the Eisenhower building, and they were at war, and they were right there, and the man in charge, the chief of staff, said to the admiral that was in charge of the naval forces, "Are you ready?" Now, this is what my brother told me, and he said, the admiral said, "Ready. Manned and ready." And he looked at the army and said, "Are you ready?" The man in charge of the army's forces. And he said, "No, I need 30 days. And that was to be expected. Because the army, even though it's regular, it's not where it needs to be. It's not ready in the way the Navy is. The Navy is always at sea. Always the ships at sea are always armed. And they're always fully loaded with ammunition, if they're online and combat ready. It's that way 24/7, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. That's the ultimate example of readiness. But there is regular army. They're more ready than the reserves, too. It's just that they have different duties, and there's a different way to, they have different responsibilities, and they can't be in the same condition of readiness because they're not Johnny on the spot. They're not nearby. They don't sail the seven seas. But a strong body makes the mind strong, said Tom Jefferson. As to the species of exercises, he says, I advise the gun. While this gives moderate exercise to the body, it gives boldness, enterprise, and independence to the mind. Listen to him. He says, games played with the ball, football, basketball, baseball, are too violent for the body and stamp no character on the mind. That's what Tom Jefferson said. Then he ends, he says, let your gun, therefore, be your constant companion of your walks. And Tom Jefferson liked to walk and chew tobacco. That was his favorite thing in the evening. And his shirt, the people that knew him said, his white shirt, which was in style at that time, had tobacco juice all over the front of it. But he apparently thought it was important that he arm himself on his walks. Our founders wanted Americans, such as Tom Jefferson, to be smartly armed, ready to stop the oppressor, whether within or without. Well, we're going to talk next time more particularly about this word, ready, and regulate. Regulated, well regulated, what does it mean, and how does this comport with the other uses in our Constitution of the word regular and regulated? And we'll talk about what that means and how important it is and how it's ignored and how it also has been hackneyed and hijacked. But that's all I have for this evening, John. I think I've gone over a little, but I probably started a little late. But I appreciate, again, the opportunity to talk about the law of the land and what it means. And our militia clauses are the supreme law of our land.
Okay, thank you, Brent. All right, we'll open up for a couple of questions for Brent. If anybody has any questions or comments, star six. Well, let me open up to the Q&A first. We're still in lecture mode, so. All right, anybody has a question or a comment for Brent, star six to get into the queue. And so if anybody has anything, star six to get into the queue. All right, our first caller, let's see, is 503 area code. You've been unmuted. Go right ahead.
Hey. Hello.
Give us your first name and state.
Ronald. Oregon.
Ronald from Oregon. Go right ahead, Ronald.
And who? What was the man's name that just gave that nice talk?
That was Brent Winters.
Brent Winters?
Yes.
Where's he from?
He's the author of The Excellence in Common Law, and he's got the website commonlawyer.com. Go right ahead. Ask your question or your comment to Brent. He's listening.
Help me help the rest of the convicted men who have had their so-called names barred from forever exercising their so-called right to keep themselves protected with a pistol or a rifle and real bullets.
Yes, and I didn't catch the first part of what you said, Ronald. What was your question exactly?
Help me help myself, first of all, and then help other men and women whose right has been attacked or abolished by the Bar Association after we are convicted.
Yeah, that's a big problem, and it's part of an orchestrated, in my studied opinion, part of an orchestrated effort to disarm Americans. And as I'd said before, there are more people in America that are jailed now per capita than any place in the world. And in most of those cases, it results in the government saying that a man can't own the weapon of his choice. And then compound that with, it effectually disarms his whole family. Now, the law is not settled on that point, and I don't know that, well, I know it shouldn't, and it doesn't. You can't use one right against another lawfully that way, but if a man lives here or there, goes here or there, then the people where he lives, his spouse or his the rest of his family, the accusation is possible that he has access to a gun, and that therefore they're all breaking the law, he's breaking the law, then everybody has to be disarmed. Well, that's the idea of what is happening. Now, I'm just commenting on the problem. I'm not saying there's always the solution everybody wants, but the law is now written so that at the end of 10 years after a conviction, a fellow can reapply and have his name removed. But the government so far has said we're not going to fund anyone to do that, to process that paperwork. The case has been brought before the United States Supreme Court and arguing I'm entitled to this. The law says that after 10 years, I'm entitled to my rights being reinstated. And the Supreme Court said, well, if there's no money, there's nothing we can do about that. We can't make them do this. That was the comment of the Supreme Court of the United States. But obviously, and in my opinion, yes, obviously, if a man hasn't been convicted of a violent crime, he certainly that shouldn't even be a question. But even if he has been convicted of a violent crime, it's still questionable. It shouldn't be questioned. The Constitution makes this point, and that's what it means when it says infringement. But there are so many laws on the books now, and there's so many crimes. I had one case at home, fella. Was in a situation where his wife got a restraining order from him in a small rural court, and I knew the judge that issued the restraining order, which is just par for the course, and he was driving down a state highway and got stopped for a taillight out or going 5 miles over the speed limit. It was some kind of a moving violation or a problem with his equipment. I forget what it was, pickup truck. State policeman stopped him. and gave him a warning or a ticket. That's not the important point. The state policeman noticed, and this is the important point, that he had a rifle in his gun rack behind his seat, and made note of that, and of course found out that he was under a restraining order. Well, when the feds found out about it, and I don't know how the state police got it to the feds or how they found out, the feds came sailing in and charged him with possession of a firearm while he was under a restraining order. And by the way, that's a little-known law, that when a fellow's under a restraining order from a state court, it's a federal law that says if you have a firearm in your possession, you've committed a felony, and you get a lot of time in jail. I think this guy got 7 years. And he went to federal trial. He went all the way to trial. He said this is ridiculous. His lawyer agreed. The jury, I don't know what's the matter with juries, but they convicted him. And he appealed all the way to the Seventh Circuit, the Seventh Federal Circuit up in Chicago. And Judge Posner wrote the opinion. He was extremely upset. He said, this is terrible. It's wrong. And he described all the reasons why it's wrong. And the main reason was, he said, nobody's on notice about this. And, of course, this guy complained that the state judge in this little county court didn't tell him that he was in danger of being prosecuted and sent to prison for 7 to 10 years, some crazy thing. And but the appellate court said, this is wrong. It needs to be changed. But there's nothing we can do about it. You know, that old line, my hands are tied. Well, I don't think their hands are tied. I think they can say no. And I think in this case, Posner didn't have the power to say no because he was in the dissent. He dissented from the majority opinion. But he wrote the most persuasive dissent. I don't remember the name of the case, but it happened in Robinson, Illinois, before Judge Correll. Well, I knew the judge and knew the place it happened. And it was a pretty big case around the country because it put everybody on notice. The feds have really overstepped their bounds here. Now, I don't imagine Congress has done anything about it. That's just another example. It's not just people that have been convicted of a so-called felony that may not be felonious at all. It may just be some another statute Congress has passed.
Whoa. So you're saying that in Posner here, this man here that had that experience, you're saying his only fault was that he didn't remind for the record that he wasn't given proper notice, that if he continued to practice his life, he was going to face charges?
No, that's just one of the arguments that he made at the appellate level. He made every argument you could make, and that was one of them. And truly, it'd be good if the judge did put you on notice. But Posner's real point was, this is just unconstitutional that this should happen. But I don't think Posner went all the way and said the law is unconstitutional. But it's odd how judges are. Posner later, after the Heller decision in 2008, there was the McDonald decision that was went to the Supreme Court. And it upheld the Heller decision. Heller just applied to federal property like the District of Columbia. The McDonald decision, which was just like it, applied to the states and said the states cannot keep people from keeping and bear arms. Well, Posner listened to that case on appeal, and he said this. He said the state of Illinois has 180 days to get something in place that people don't have to be afraid to carry a pistol. And if the state of Illinois, the legislature doesn't do it, the federal court's going to do it for them. So that was Posner coming back the other way. Of course, Posner just said, I'm not going to go back over Heller. They've made their point, and we're bound by their decision, and we're going to uphold it. And then he went with it. It'd be educational and informative to read those cases. You can go to the website for the Supreme Court and listen to the arguments in the Heller decision. They're all there on audio. You don't have to read them. You can just listen to them. And you can also go and listen to Posner and his comments and the arguments concerning the McDonald decision, the Seventh Federal Circuit.
I'd like to make a comment on this, though, if I could.
Yeah, go ahead.
Let you have the mic back, Ronald. Yeah, when that was appealed, was that appealed in the Supreme Court within that state or to the United States Supreme Court? Who heard that the appeal?
On the one before Posner, you're talking about that. I think that just went to Posner and they slapped him down. And they were really upset with the Attorney General of the state of Illinois, and they said, we note with disapproval that you've tried to deceive us, and you only quoted part of the case that they were trying to use to uphold their position.
Well, I'll tell you what I believe happened here. When that judge made that decision, not that the judge made the decision. When the jury made that decision, they made that decision because they were tainted. And I've seen this over and over and over again. You come to the end of the case, okay, and then the judge will turn to the jury and say to the jury, you get to decide the facts.
Yep.
But I will decide the law. And if this man, no matter what reason, if it's proven that he had a gun and it broke that statute, you must convict. And that's what happened. That's tainting a jury. That's taken away their rights of nullification. And that man should be jailed, in my opinion. So,
well, and I imagine that. I know that does happen a lot. I wasn't there when that jury charge was given.
Yeah, I'd bet you dollars to donuts that's what happened.
Yeah, it's routine.
Where did the statutes gain the control over the common man, the individual, as Brent points out here?
Yeah. You're saying they did gain control over him? I didn't catch that.
I said, where do the statutes gain control? Where am I written in the Oregon Revised Statutes? Where are the statutes causing me a duty to perform? Where have I agreed?
Well, you're not. None of us agree that that's the case with you, Ronald. They've decided that for us, and that's our purpose here at National Liberty Alliance alone is to stop these statutes that are written to control the behavior of people. My behavior is my fault, and until I injure someone, they can't say anything about my behavior. But once I injure someone, then that's a whole different story. And for every injury, there must be a remedy. But these states, of course, and even the federal government, they make all these statutes up to control our behavior, and that's the problem. And we all agree with you. That's
what's happening to these men from Oregon that were involved in standing up for their rights, protecting their land rights, et cetera, and supporting the one that was murdered. How come somebody hasn't put a bond in for them or done something to?
Well, we've done something there.
Why are they all sitting in there? I don't like ducks on the fence that don't know that the statutes, they're not written in the statutes either.
Well, I'd like to just comment on that one because we here at National Liberty Alliance have done something about that. We have called together the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury, who has come together, and we have done habeas corpuses on all of those people. Now, they have ignored the habeas corpus. We did it on the Hammonds, and we did it on the Bundys, and all the other individuals that were arrested with the Bundys, both in Oregon and out in Arizona. And
if they can't be tracked under the common law with something like the habeas you're speaking of, then why not come at it under public policy and somebody bond their butts out of there?
Well, it's not that simple.
We know that it's not them they're holding, that they're holding the resident, the thing, the person.
Hold on. I had to mute you there, so no one's hearing you right now at the moment until I unmute you, because let me finish off what I was saying in the first place. We have some paperwork being prepared as we speak to go into the courts out there to deal with the problem and to bring a prosecution into play. But there's also a lot of other activities going on, by the way. And, I got little bits and pieces of what's happening out there, and I have to consult with some people who do have the knowledge of what's going on out there to find out what's happening. We do know that some counter charges have been made by some of the people that are arrested. They are getting some backing by some of the media out there, at least the local media. So that's a good thing too. And our paperwork will be going in very soon also. We have been held up by our paperwork only by the problems that we've had. This is maybe one of your first times here, so I don't know if you're a member or if you come often, but it sounds like you don't. So you're just finding us, I'm presuming. But for the members or the other people that are listening in and have been listening for a long time, we've been trying to get paperwork into Oregon for quite some time, but we have been delayed for one reason or another. Ultimately, it's circumstances, so ultimately it's God that's delaying us, I believe, anyway. But nevertheless, we just had a situation that really has kind of set us back a couple of weeks trying to fix that problem, and now we've come to that point where that problem is fixed, so we should be back on point with the Oregon case. And I'm hoping within the next couple of weeks to have papers to file in that Oregon case to do something about that. Now, I do know that there are other forces trying to do things. I don't know how successful or what chances they have, but I think we have one of the biggest chances. And we do have some friendly media involved out there that we should be able to make contact with to get the message out and really start to open up that hornet's nest and bring justice back into that court out there. So with that, Ron, let me unmute you so you can comment some more. Go right ahead.
Thank you for that bit of commentary on there and giving me some briefing on that action, because I'm really aloof with the knowledge about out here, especially with having Winston Strout just indicted, and now I understand, you know, he puts in a document and they've decided they're not going to push the prosecution of that so-called case right now. But there seems to be a big political current here in Oregon now, with all sorts of things going on, from the murder there of all these children in Roseburg right around the time that the governor's stepping down and his girlfriend with him, from them just going off the hook here with the houseless crowd, and no injured party, you know, no verified complaint from an injured party, like these men that are being held with these huge federal offenses, you know, these heavy federal charges, without a verified complaint from an injured party. I mean, if anything, the people of Oregon that this Brent speaks to are the injured party, because they had a member of their militia that was murdered on television.
Right. Well, we see the injustice just as you do. We understand the problem just like you do, and you're absolutely right. There is no injured party. They have no documentation from any injured party, and so therefore they don't have a case. Again, we've done habeas corpus, and they've defaulted on them, all the habeas corpus. We've done habeas corpus for all of them. I think there's about 40 or 50 of them altogether, including the Hammonds and that, and they defaulted. They did not answer because they cannot answer. So, anyway, with that, do you want to have a final word on that, Brent? Would you like to make a comment to finish off?
Oh, no, don't think I have anything more I could add. You know more about the Oregon situation than I do. You've been involved with it. I just know what I see in the news. But I'm disappointed. I'm deeply disappointed in the government out there and the state police, of course. No, I have nothing else to say.
Okay. Ronald, you got a final comment before we move to the next caller?
I have a question with a comment. Brent, is your last name Winter?
Winter's with an S, like Jonathan and Shelley. You remember Shelley and Jonathan Winters?
Yeah, okay. Well, I heard mention of a book that you wrote. I'm interested in finding out how I can get that book.
Oh, you go. It's my name is Brent Allen Winters on the Internet. Brent Allen Winters. Just go to Amazon.com and type in Brent Allen Winters, and it'll come up. The name of the book is Excellence of the Common Law. Excellence of the Common Law. And there are other books. There are also the book on the militia. These presentations come largely from the book.
Were you ever
on the
a
militia.
Member of the bar yourself, Brent? Were you ever a member of the bar yourself?
Yeah, I was, yeah, but I quit them. But I'm a lawyer. I'm a licensed lawyer, but I'm not the member of any bar now.
What do you say? What do you mean when you say you're a licensed lawyer? What does that mean?
That means that, well, I'm glad you asked. Maybe other people have the same question. I think every state licensed lawyers to practice law within its jurisdiction. And every state does it either by two methods. Either the Supreme Court of that state licensed lawyers, or the Bar Association of that state licensed lawyers. If you're in a state like California where the Bar Association licenses and has power of discipline over lawyers, then you have to belong to the bar to be a lawyer in that state. You have to. You don't have any choice. It's mandatory membership. But if you're in a state where the Supreme Court of the state, the highest court of the state, licenses lawyers and disciplines them, has that power, then you don't have to belong to any bar association. And that's why I don't belong. I'm in a state that doesn't the Supreme Court of the state has the power of discipline and control of lawyers and licensing and things like that.
So are you able to practice in their venues?
I practice law in the state courts, and I've practiced in the, but I can practice by permission. I have in other states, but it's only at the pleasure of those judges in those states. And then the federal courts, of course, that's a nationwide thing. And so in those areas, I can practice, but if I leave my own state, it's by permission. It's always by permission in the courts. That's why we say when we begin to argue.
What state do you practice in?
Illinois.
Illinois. Okay. Wow. Interesting. I thought anybody that joined the bar was voluntarily. And then in order to practice in their courts, in order to become a member of the bar, you had to pass a test, and then it's voluntary at that point.
No, the fact is, I know people who belong to the bar associations of all the many different states just because they want to receive their publications. You don't have to be a lawyer to belong to the bar. And I think you can even belong to the bars of like in states like California, where it's mandatory. They just want the fee. If you pay them the money, you can join. You don't have to be a lawyer. But if you're going to practice law in California, you've got to be a member of the bar. If you're going to practice law in Illinois, you've got to be, the Supreme Court has to issue a license instead of the Bar Association. And the American Bar, so there are two bar associations fundamentally in America. There's the American Bar Association, which is very powerful. And then there's each state has a bar association. And then often a city, large cities will have bar associations. And then even two or three rural counties.
Where do attorneys have the authority to practice that, according to the American Bar Association's website?
Where do they have the authority to practice?
According to the American Bar Association's website of Washington, D.C.
Oh, I don't know what the American Bar Association website says on that point. I can just tell you how it works. I've practiced, for example, in federal courts in Oregon before. By permission, I've gone into court there and practiced, but not the state court. I have practiced in the state appellate courts of Washington by permission. Case-by-case basis, that you ask them, may I represent this person, and then you pay them a fee, and they'll either say yes or no. It's up to them entirely, and you don't argue with them. But if you're licensed to practice in a particular state, you can go into those courts anytime, as long as your license is correct.
You write your pleadings appropriately then, so that the man maintains his rights, he's not drawn in as any accommodating party, or for sure?
You're asking me if I write the pleadings that way?
Yes.
I write the pleadings, so I think that whatever it takes, so I think the judge will read them and that he will give my client the best shake. And there's a right way to do it and a wrong way to do it. And it's all a matter, too, of tone and personality. It all becomes very personal.
Isn't that the problem that we're all having? We're misunderstood. We're misled with the difference of understanding there in that venue and how to get our common law remedy versus the commercial process?
Well, all that's kind of true. I'll give you one example, and this is a real-life example of the difference. There's only, and I say this in my book, Excellence of the Common Law, there's only two kinds of law in the world and only two kinds of lawyers. There are lawyers of the law of the land, the common law, called common lawyers traditionally, and then there are lawyers of the law of the city, called civilians, traditionally is the name for them. Around the world, they're called civilians. That means law of the city, civil. Civil law lawyers and common law lawyers, that's all there is. And when you go into court, the courts increasingly in our own country have taken on the principles of the law of the city. You call it, I've heard people call it the law merchant, and there's, or the martial law, or international law, the equity. There are different ways to say it. It's all the same stuff. There are two different kinds of laws. If you go into court, the idea is the law of the city will press in on you. And it's important that you argue as you understand the fundamental law. We all, you and me and other people, it's incumbent upon us, if we're going to keep our freedoms, that we become lawyers of first principles and that we understand the law according to first principles, according to fundamental rights. Don't get
any reason.
Up.
Any reason we all can't know that by the fourth grade?
Say again.
Any reason we all can't begin to know that by the fourth grade?
No, that ought to be taught that early on. As a matter of fact, I have a friend up in Alaska who's a lawyer that practices in the federal courts. I know his father; he's more my age than he, but we're friends, both of them. And he has my book, Excellence of the Common Law, and he's reading it to his two boys. One of them 6 years old or seven. The other ones, they're along in there somewhere. They're reading these books. These boys catch on. You know, their minds are fresh. They're not tainted. They're not overloaded. And I'm amazed what they repeat to me. I talk to them sometimes.
Is it a thing they call like pettifog and poppycock?
Say again?
Yeah, you say those boys' minds aren't overloaded with anything like they call pettifog or poppycock?
Yeah, that's right. And poppycock has a distinct meaning in the Dutch language. It's a Dutch word, and it'd be worth going to look up exactly what poppycock is. It's important to understand that, in my opinion. Yeah, and their minds aren't overloaded with it. But even if your mind is, the only way to cleanse your mind is with the truth. And the Bible says that. The Bible says that if you fill your mind constantly with the truth, it will overload and push out the wrong ideas. And no matter how smart a fellow may think he is, if his mind has been pumped full of wrong ideas, no matter how rich he is, if he's been pumped full of wrong ideas, he's a fool. And he will continue to be a fool, and in the end, the Bible says he's going to go down. And it's not going to be pretty. And the only way to change your ways, to do right, is to meditate. That means ruminate. That's the old Latin word. That means chew the cud. That means take in the laws of nature, unwritten in creation, and the laws of nature's God written in the Bible, and constantly be reading them and have them in your mind, plant them in mental sod, and you will ruminate them, and it will change your actions. It'll change the way you think. And then when you talk, you'll say things that are worthwhile more and more and more, and other people will begin to hear things that are worthwhile. Our first fathers, called the Pilgrims, left England from a place called Scrooby, and it was against the law for them to hold church services, so they held them secretly in a barn. And before they left England, they all made a covenant one with another. They swore to one another that they would do something. And what they swore that they would do was this. They said, we covenant with each other, just a small group of them. They said, we covenant with each other that we will speak the words of God into one another's minds. They didn't have tape players. They didn't have internet. They didn't have recordings. So they said that they promised each other this because they knew that was the only way that they would be empowered to do what it was God wanted them to do. And what God wanted them to do was this. He wanted them to dominate the land, and they couldn't do it where they were. That's why they came to the New World, so they could carve domination out of the wilderness in the New World, and they did that. But they knew the only power they had to do it was to have the law of God, the will of God, his expression by words in their minds, in the core of their being. That's what they call the heart. You have it in there, and it will control your actions, and it will control your speech. You'll be a new man. You'll have a new mind, and you'll do new and intrepid and brave and enterprising things that you never thought you could do before. That's how it happens. It doesn't happen any other way, by the way. There is the only way. One of the most fascinating books, I want to get a copy of it. I've heard people talk about it. I've read about it. Is Christopher Columbus's Bible. Copies of Columbus's Bible can be bought with his notes in the margins. And what he believed God was driving him to do and why he left Europe. If God gets in your system, the way he does it through his law, his will. If he gets in your system, you'll do the most fascinating things. I read history. I watch what men do, and it's always the same. It's not just God. It's not just some mystical idea about God telling people what to do. It's men getting the idea in their heads through the law of God, the laws of nature, and the laws of nature's God of how to do that. Christopher Columbus understood two volumes, the laws of nature, written in creation. A sailor can't sail unless he'll die if he doesn't understand the laws of nature. Yes.
Do you do anything to try to help get Leroy Michael Schweitzer out of prison?
Where are they?
He was one of the Montana Freemen. Did you do anything to try to help him out?
Oh, yeah, that would have been a long time ago. No, I've known people and been involved with that. I've done nothing with it. No, I've never been asked to. I've never put my mind to it, and I don't know anything about it. I know who they are, and I know people that were indicted by them or with them that did go to prison that got out. I've met them over the years.
Right. I'd like to make a comment here. I'd like to read something just real quick. It's one verse. We had read this earlier in our opening part of the program. We read out of Romans chapter 12.
Yeah.
But because of what you had just mentioned, Brent, I'd like to just read this, verse 2 of Romans 12. Mm-hmm. And be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. So I think that concludes it. I'd like to, Ronald, I appreciate all your questions, and that's why I let you go on so long, because I thought they were very good questions.
Yeah, I got to know if Brent's read the Book of Enoch.
Pardon?
Has Brent read Enoch?
Yes, I have. But I hasten to add, it's worth reading, but it's not the Bible, although the Bible does quote it. The Bible lifts things out of it, but it's not on the same level.
Hey, Brent, would you like to have your phone number?
Pardon?
I have your phone number, Brent?
No, but you can contact me on the website. Go to commonlawyer.com, go to the contact page, and you can email there, and maybe we can make connection if you need to talk.
Thank you.
Hey, okay, thank
Ronald,
you.
Appreciate your questions, and again, that's why we let you go so long.
You all out there in New York, thank you for keeping the call up. And how many people are on the call tonight?
Well, we had about 100 and change a little while ago. We're down to about 96, but people are coming in and out throughout the 3 hours here. So
I got a question for you.
Which is actually kind of low. Usually we're almost 200, but go ahead.
I got a question for you. There were several Monday nights that I missed your call. I don't know if you were even on. I called, but I never did hear anybody talk. And then it's about that time I was hearing this Anna von Reitzer. I'm probably mispronouncing her name, but she speaks a lot like Mr. Winters does, and she was saying some things about you and how she talked to you about different aspects of common law, grand jury, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, we have two very different views, and I try to keep it civil, and I don't get into the arguments he said, she said, so I'm not going to concern myself with that, but my position is well known. And we've made our position one time to her. There's no reason to go back and forth quivering over it. And, I hope her well and what she's doing and safe, you know. And hopefully she hopes the same for me. So we appreciate
good.
The call, Ron, and you're welcome to get back and ask more questions later, but we do have to move on. So
thank you.
Okay. Okay, next is Debbie from Virginia.
Virginia. I'm using her phones, my wife.
Okay.
For Brenners, Brent Weathers, Mr. Winters, you hit a button on mine earlier about how government is, overseeing and encouraging, using terms and words that confuse. And I kind of been noticing by studying the law, and I've been studying contracts, and the reason for that is both scriptural. We got lots of scriptures. Of course, the Bible itself is a contract or a covenant, which means the same thing. I've come to understand that law and contract is really interchangeable. They're the same thing. Contracts are law, and law is contract. Under Article 1, Section 10, it says, that no state can, hinder the obligation of contracts. Obligation, of course, is a definite legal term, and it's mentioned many times, and even the old cowboys would constantly say, much obliged. So that was recognition, I guess, of some kind of responsibility. But the next thing that I'm talking about is we have this fiction operating, and we have common law, we have this statutory law, and then we have contract law. And the nexus between those, I believe, at some point, someone's going to have to address the issue, because you can't eliminate commerce through contract law, because commerce and capitalism, it's either legal, like Frederick Bastiat, the French statesman, made the comments in his book known as The Law about legal plunder and how it affects nations, how it makes a whole nation of people become thieves, because they have to steal from each other to survive. So everybody's stealing. And that's kind of where we're at now. And I believe that nexus is the contract. And they're controlling and putting their authority over us because we're ignorant and not understanding the contract laws and these, what they call adhesion contracts. And I hope John don't pull the plug on me. But I'm not going to go into that realm. But I know we have a nexus there. And I was wondering what your thoughts might be on that nexus between contract law, commerce, and so forth.
Well, you mentioned covenants and contract being the same thing. Covenant's an unfortunate word. The reason we have the word covenant, because the men who led the Reformation were all lawyers of the law of the city. They were Roman priests, and that's what a Roman priest is. He's not a student of the Bible. He's a He's a lawyer of the civil law. The canon law of Rome is the Code of Justinian. So that word covenant, it being a Latin word from the Roman Church, crept into our understanding. And you made the point that it's kind of a contract, but it's a little bit different. The covenant that's referred to in the Bible is simply this, and I'll bring it back to our discussion on rights. The covenant of the Bible is God says, here's what I'm going to do in my sovereignty. I'm going to do this. Do you agree or disagree? And you can either join him or you cannot join him. If you say, I agree, then as it says of Abraham, Abraham said amen to God, and it was counted to him for righteousness. Then you're part of his trust settlement called a covenant. I don't like the word. But it's just you agreeing with God. That's what it is. Him saying, here's what I'm going to do no matter what. Do you want to fight me and go along peaceably, or do you want to go along peaceably and join me? That's what a covenant is in the Bible. And the covenants of God, when God deposited and he delegated to us our responsibilities, called our rights, and we either accept them wholeheartedly with all of our being and all of our energy, or we reject them. And if we reject them, then we become enemies of God. If we accept them, we say, amen, I agree, I think that's a good idea, and I'll see what I can do to facilitate this situation, kind of go along with it and not fight it. That's being part of the covenant people of God. That's what a contract is, two people agreeing. That's what it is. But in this case, it's a greater, the allodial landowner, as it were, God himself, and we just agree with him. Now, people say that's an adhesion contract. Well, yeah, in that case, it probably is, but he's God. And when men try to do things like that, they're playing God. When men try to have adhesion contracts, our common law says that's unfair, and we're not going to allow it. Now, as far as the law merchant goes, and people talk about the law merchant and the contract and how I call a lot of it gets mixed up with what I call patriot mythology. And it's sincere often, but it's mythology. The law merchant was something that occurred in Europe for expediency. And the people would trade between countries, and they didn't have if you're trading with somebody in England and you're from France or Italy, and you're bringing your wares to England, well, you don't understand the common law, and frankly, the common law, the Englishmen don't apply it to you. But they noticed that if they didn't give these foreigners a fair shake, they wouldn't bring their goods to England, and they wanted their goods. So they developed what became the UCC, the Uniform Commercial Code. It wasn't called that, but it was developed because of the work of a Scotsman named Murray. And this Scotsman became Chief Justice in England, and he was called Lord Mansfield. Lord Mansfield, his name is really Murray. Well, he came up with the idea that since the law merchant, the way they were doing it, it was a law of expediency, which all of the law of the city is. It's not a law of process, slow and sure-footed. A law of expediency, whatever works fast. He said, since we're doing that, we need to have the jury mixed up in this. So what he did was he devised a jury to use with the law merchant when foreigners came to England. Half of them, they called them juries of the half-tongue. Juries of the half-tongue. And these things are referenced, by the way, in Magna Carta. They were used for centuries before Mansfield came along. Mansfield came along about the time of our separation from England. But the jury of the half-tongue, he took that and the jury of the half-tongue was a jury that was half foreigners. If the guy was from France, the merchant, they would be half French-speaking people and half English-speaking people. Well, that seemed fair enough. Matter of fact, that's kind of a common law principle. Well, that worked out pretty well for a long time, but Mansfield said, you know, these merchant laws are so complex, and these customs they've developed over the centuries. We want to do trading. We want to trade with Europe, the rest of Europe. We need to have a jury that understands the merchants. So he impaneled a jury of 12 of merchants that understood the customs, and he called upon them to come and sit as a jury and to have jurisdiction in these cases that otherwise would have no jury at all. So he developed this idea through this jury and learning the customs, the UCC, what we now call the UCC, which is now every state has adopted some form of it according to each state's sensibilities. That became the UCC. The UCC is really good in this sense because it does keep commerce, as our Constitution says, regular. We use that word Second Amendment, a well-regulated militia. Well, the purpose of the Commerce Clause of our Constitution, not to mention a lot of other parts of it, is to keep commerce regular between the states, which are foreign, a foreign country, each to the other. They're called, even though, although they're sister states, they're also called, as to each other, foreign states. And so the Uniform Commercial Code, because it's rather uniform throughout the country, each state is not hampering it. They're trying to have some agreement because there's so much commerce between states. It's a law of expediency. It has its drawbacks because of its expediency. And if you're not a merchant, you don't fall under the UCC. You've got to meet certain criteria for the UCC in your state to apply to the transaction that you're disagreeing about with somebody, either you or another person. Depends upon your state whether it has to be two merchants, and the code's very specific about all those things. But it is true that you can enter into what somebody else says is their agreement and not know it. And I do believe the evil empire does do that, and they do it a lot. They get you to sign a lot of things and agree to a lot of things. I mean, every time a cop stops you on the road, he asks questions, and all those questions are designed to do. He's trained to try to get a confession out of you. Well, where are you going? First, he wants to get you talking. You know, just relax. Just relax, because once you get relaxed, you'll answer every question he asks. Where are you going? Having a nice day, et cetera, et cetera. Yes, 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 yes. Well, then, did you know you were speeding? And if you say, well, yeah, I know it was 5 miles over, well, that ends the case. There's no sense going to court. He's got a confession out of you. So those are the kind of things you don't want to agree to.
Because the word has been copyrighted, so to speak, because of the term. You know, the word, you know, the words, they're using certain words like employee, unemployment, driver, license, you know, and if you ask the questions and you're using that word, you're in this statutory zone.
And well,
that's
you can't.
A difficulty for us with the NLA because we're trying to avoid that. But
yeah.
It seems to me these are certain issues we have to address. If they're using it as a nexus and a means to violate our rights, which is what it sounds like there's going on out there in Oregon, it's going on everywhere.
In mass, and it's fraud.
So do you feel it's necessary, or would you say it was advisable for us to, at some point to start learning the contract, you know, contract law, maybe learning how they're getting us in these various nexuses so we can avoid it? Because
no, I think it's overwhelming. I think it's overwhelming. I think it gets people caught up in minutia that just doesn't. It's not going to make any difference. The thing that I think we need to concentrate on is the fundamental supreme law of the land, because that's something that we all can grasp. And the truth is, even when you go into court, judges don't want to get caught up in all that minutia. They want things to be brief, pointed, and to the point, and fast and quick, and that means fundamental law, fundamental rights. The Supreme Court of the United States, for instance, they're not interested in cases unless they're really. It's easier to get into the Supreme Court if you're dealing with a fundamental right. That's where it's at, and that's what the Bible tells us to do. If you get caught up in the minutiae, you're caught up in the evil empire. They've got you. They'll entangle you with detail that doesn't matter. I got asked to do a bank case, a bank fraud case. Bank stole a lot of money from a fella, and I didn't want to do it. I don't know anything about banking law. Can you imagine how complicated it'd be to go up against a big bank like Citibank or a Bank of America or one of those kind of things? And I couldn't find a lawyer to take the case. And finally, I took the case, and the guy that I was helping said, why'd you take the case? I said, well, I finally decided that the Bible says that stealing's against the law. He who takes what isn't his'n shall pay the price or go to prison. I learned that when I was a kid. I didn't learn that in law school. So I don't need to worry about all that minutia, and I don't intend to argue it, and I don't think anybody does. There are 10 fundamental principles here. The book of Hebrews, chapter 5, tells us to concentrate on them. It says the problem with you fellows is you're not enjoying the Christian life because you have chosen to get caught up in minutia when you need to just concentrate on the, and he uses these words, this is the meaning of the literal meaning of the Greek text, the unwrought rudiments. The unwrought elements. Unwrought, yes, that means untouched by the hands of men. Well, what's untouched by the hands of men? What's untouched by the hands of men are the commandments that God wrote with his own finger. That's the point there. Now, when Moses came off the mountain, he wrote the 10 things. They're not commandments, really. They're the 10 matters, the 10 principles. He wrote them with his own finger. And those are what we are to concentrate on. And there's 10 of them. And with those, all of the will of God falls under at least one of those 10, if not two or three. That's all right there. Those are the 10 fundamental first principles. First principles. And any lawyer that does not practice law by first principles is not a common lawyer, and that's why we're in the shape we're in. We need to constantly go back to the fundamentals and never get away from the fundamentals. Just get better at using them.
Well, would you agree that these persons that do practice that kind of stuff, would it be advisable for people to file claims against these individuals or complaints? A claim would be more common law. A complaint would be more statutory, and I don't know whether that's a public or a private. But I tend to look at things as trying to stay in private and not get involved with public.
Oh, well, no, I think that's right, too. If you get the government involved, there's any money there, they'll try to get it, or somehow they end up getting it and nobody gets helped. You don't get a remedy. But who is it you said you wanted to go after or were thinking about going after?
Well, if you had, like, a bad sheriff or a judge that's not giving, you know, like these gentlemen out there in Oregon, if you've got a sheriff that's not doing his job and he's participating in murdering this man, set him up for a kill, and he hasn't really violated or done any harm, and yet they're laying in wait with this man. It was obvious that he was laying in wait, and they murdered him. He wasn't armed. It's so obvious.
Yeah.
Should we not charge these men? Should we not file a claim? If we can't get a good, honorable grand jury within the state to do it, then should not an individual or a group of individuals file charges or file
sure.
a claim?
I'd like to beat the family ought to file a wrongful death against the people that shot him. The wrongful death. You're talking about private remedies, wrongful death action. I'm surprised it hasn't been done. I don't know what's going on out there.
Wrongful day.
What wrongful death? It's
well,
a common law action.
Death. Oh, okay. Well, that's what I'm wondering, right? Because I see stuff all the time going on, and I'm like, why aren't people, I've been trying to, this is one of the things I've been teaching here in my state before I ever got involved with in L.A., we need to start learning how to file claims and filing charges because we don't seem to have a grand jury. We can't find how to approach them because they're controlled. So here's the way
to learn how to file papers in court. And now we have the internet. We used to just lawyers do this. Just go to the courthouse, find a case that's somewhat like yours, in the file, copy it, and then see how it can be used as a template to get yours written. Find something that has been accepted in the court. Some lawyers filed it, and it looks like it's pretty good. Use that as a template. And with every complaint that's filed, there's a set of elements you've got to fulfill. You got to show this, facts that show this, this, and this. It's always best to have a lawyer who knows what he's doing. Notice I said who knows what he's doing and is comfortable in the courts of your state. But I recognize that people don't have money to do that. And if they don't have money to do that, the Supreme Court of the United States has rightly ruled that people have the right to represent themselves, if that's all they can do. And they shouldn't be looked down upon, and they shouldn't be thrown out of court. But you do need to file papers.
When they're talking about private attorney generals, I guess that's the same thing if you're prosecuting your own case.
Yeah, in a way. Yeah, you are. But you're not an attorney general. You're just a guy. A man in court, you're trying to get your rights vindicated. I mean, if somebody murdered your husband, that's what happened to that West Point graduate that was working for the feds that shot Randy Weaver's wife. They sued him. And they ended up settling for quite a chunk of money. I don't think they got all of it, but they settled for a lot.
I didn't know that ever settled. I was surprised. What happened to the man that shot the... They shot her.
I'd have to imagine by this time he's having trouble sleeping at night, and who knows what else. I don't know. I hope that's what's happened.
I would have hoped because I would think somebody like that should have been charged. He should be punished, not get away with it, because this is a problem. The government doesn't fear us, and they're going to continue to do this until we put the fear back in them.
Well, in a
godly way. I don't mean a dreadful fear, but I mean a godly way.
Well,
and I'm thankful for what you're saying because I was, really hoping for clarification, but also on that nexus of the connection between the UCC and the commercial, what they call the common law, and how they're using it to tie in statutes on it. But I do have my own set of older books of jurisprudence. You mentioned going to court. And I've been looking at these older versions of the jurisprudence books that I have, and I've gleaned a lot out of just looking at those cases and, of course, researching a few other cases, you know.
Uh-huh.
But that's still a good thing, though, to do that. I like what you said because that's I believed in that very much. I believe that's what we should do, and that's what I've been trying to get a lot of people in my state here to do with tea parties and so forth. But they just always seem to think I'm wasting my time.
What state are you in again?
A lot of the people here in my state.
What state?
Tea party.
He's
oriented.
In Virginia.
Where?
And, they don't agree with my view that we should be filing charges when we have a government official that's violated the people's rights and he's not doing his job as prescribed.
I still didn't hear what state you're in. What state are you in?
He's in Virginia.
Constitutional act.
Virginia. Oh, okay. Thank you. Okay, I got you.
Okay. If we have a government official, a congressman or a senator, that's made up a bill that's totally unconstitutional, why shouldn't we bring him up on, serve him a notice and demand to, you know, cease and desist? You know, a notice, information, and demand, just like the grand jury would as an individual. And then if he doesn't take note of that and keeps pushing it, then we file charges and, you know, a complaint because he's, as far as I'm concerned, he's committed a crime.
Well, you can file a complaint. That's called the right of petition. It's in the First Amendment. You can petition the government for redress of grievances. You can petition the government for a remedy. That's what filing papers in court's all about.
Yeah, we need to have
the problem is,
thank you for confirming that. I don't want to take up everybody's time, but I really do appreciate you giving me clarification on that. I'm going to buy your book here as soon as I can possibly get it. And thank you very much, sir, for this fine explanation.
Thanks for calling.
Okay, we'll take one more caller for Brent. Let's see. It looks like Jason, 570.
Hi.
Go right ahead, Jason.
Hi. I'm wondering how this can go about that. I'm in a... what is it, the smallest court that, it's the lowest court summary charges were put on me, and I went, had a lawyer, I went to a different court hearing, but apparently it wasn't my court hearing, and I didn't know the court date that it was rescheduled for, and I already went to a court date, and I thought it was taken care of because the lawyer told me it was, and then apparently I was supposed to go to a different court date afterwards, and I didn't do that, so then I got a letter in the mail saying I have to pay a fine on this date, which would therefore mean I'm guilty, which I am not, which I was with another person with this incident where we were wrongly accused of public drunkenness and disorderly, which was completely farce. And I'm wondering how I can get this off my record because I want to make it to where I get my permit back because, A, my friend, he didn't take his permit in, too, because the sheriff asked him to, and he never handed his permit in, and they even came to his house, but he said, talk to my lawyer. And he never gave him his permit when the sheriffs asked him. Me, I was trying to be a good slave, so to say, I guess, and I went and when I got the letter in the mail thinking I'd get arrested, I went and I handed my permit in and stuff, and I thought, oh, well, I'll get it back after this. And the only thing I got in the mail instead was the charges that said I have to pay $400-some to the state for things, for, like, well, what's due or whatever, for being held guilty, which I thought I was innocent on it because I went to the other court hearing, but apparently it wasn't my court hearing because my lawyer rescheduled it for another. And I went to a different court hearing, but not the one that they rescheduled it for. Then they automatically proved me as guilty. But the police officers that were involved with this didn't show up to that court hearing either. So therefore, both parties were not there at that other court hearing, but they therefore called me guilty with it and are trying to have me pay money.
Are you in Sacramento? Are you in Sacramento, California?
No, I'm in Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
Oh, okay. So then, precisely your question. Maybe I will listen to your story. Good story, but I didn't get the question.
My question is: how do I get out of this to where I can get this off me, where I can be able to go and get my permit back again, and not have to pay money for a state where things I did not do?
Well,
because they're trying to say. Another court
Good.
I have to take it to, but I don't want to do that. I just want to make it to where I get out of it.
Uh-huh. Well, I wouldn't know because I'm not in Pennsylvania, and I don't know how the courts there work exactly, and I don't know what the statutes are. But I do know if you found a lawyer that was honest, about it, he could probably help you. But then again, you'd probably pay him more than the fine's worth by far.
Yeah, that's why I'm wondering if it's what to do, because it's a public drunkenness and similar misconduct, and it's a summary, because it's $400 and some, I think it was like $425 or something, or $460 at the end fees. And I'm like, all right, well, then if I go and pay that, but it's on my record, I think, if I pay it, but it's a summary charge, which is supposed to be the smallest of charge, can I not go and get a summary expunged from my record?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't know what the law in Pennsylvania is.
Okay.
But I have heard in other
states. Illinois. I know. Can you do that in Illinois? I'm curious with that part.
Whether it could be done in Illinois?
Yeah. If you can do it in that state, I'm sure if it's done there, it would probably be able to be done here.
It would be difficult to do. I'll say it that way.
Okay. So they don't make it no cakewalk.
No, it's not a cakewalk.
I'm just trying to. I want to get this where I don't want to pay it, because then that means I'm automatically admitting guilt. Because the other person I was with, he got out of it scot free, pretty much. Like,
is this a town court? Is this a town court?
It's a municipal building court, a Commonwealth court.
Okay, so what's the appealing? You can appeal it and see what happens there. I mean, find out what the appealing process is.
It says I have to pay the fine by the 27th of this month.
Yeah, go find out how long you have to make the appeal, and then you can let the court know that you're appealing it. You can file a paper with your intention on appealing, and you'll have so many months or whatever in order to perfect your appeal, and you'll want to do an affidavit of the truth of the matter is and bring it into the appellate court for whoever would hear that. I don't know who would hear that. You know, these municipal courts, they really don't have the authority to do what they're doing, but they are doing it. I'd imagine at least be able to take it up into the county court, but you need to appeal it. Find out what the appeal process is and then try to run through that process. And, here's the bottom line of all things, no matter how you go. And in the lower courts, you'll get away with it a lot easier you could in the upper courts when you get into the state court, for instance. But it should be all the way around, because this Supreme Court has ruled on this numerous times. The only thing necessary for a prima facie case is an affidavit, period. So all you have to do is really file an affidavit or the process. Now, there's a form. They'll tell you to fill it out. To some degree, they might help you. It should be a logical thing. And like Brent said, you can go into the records and pull cases similar to that kind of thing and see how they did it and just copy the format and work off the framework but put your information in. But your key is your affidavit. And an affidavit unrebutted rules the court. That's another point you want to make in your paperwork.
Oh, well, I was thinking, since I wasn't there at the court hearing and the police officer is supposed to be against
it. I heard the story. You want to put all that in, but you're going to want to prove that. You hearsay for that. The police officer wasn't there. How do you know he wasn't there?
My lawyer, because I called back. I went to my lawyer to say, hey, why did this happen? I thought I was expunged to this and being over. And then he called the courthouse thing, and he's like, oh, well, it's going to cost us $2,500 because you have to take it to the upper level of courts to do it.
No, but how did you know that the police officer wasn't there?
When he called into the municipal building, he probably asked the question if the officer was there, and then they were talking in their private thing. Because our valley is the third most corrupt
valley. Okay, so your lawyer told you.
It's not the lawyer, but it was the other dude. The dude that's not the lawyer, but he's like his servant, so to say.
Well, whoever that person was, you can add that into your affidavit that you were told this by this individual. And you should go to that individual and tell him that you want them to do an affidavit concerning what words he spoke. You want him to put it on paper. And I would press that issue with that individual and make that point. And I'll tell you what, I'd make that point in my affidavit. And if necessary, pull them in, let them sit down there. I unfortunately don't put the Bible out there, but I'd bring my own Bible maybe in those courts. And let him swear in the Bible, let him tell his story, the truth or lie, and bring him into the court. But anyway, we don't want to spend too much time on a case, because that's not what we're here for, to discuss.
Yeah, it's just something that I'm sure there's other people, because if this happened to me, I'm a guy that's scared crapless going in the courts because I don't want nothing to do with the court system. But you know, I get police officers that harass me, hound me, and pretty
much.
Yeah,
well, look at it. If you can't afford a lawyer, you're going to have to take care of it yourself. And the best thing to do is to start off and, you know, learn what you can. You know, take our constitutional course, take our civics course here on National Liberty Alliance. It's free. We have a book on how to access the court, how to write papers.
Yeah, my buddy, my friend, he gave it to me. Common Law Handbook. I have that thing here in my hands right now.
A Common Law Handbook by who?
It's by you, the NationalLibertyAlliance.org.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, that's a handbook for common law. It's a handbook for judges, sheriffs, and jurists, and so on and so forth. But, of course, that's the real law in there, you know. And they're not going to adhere too much to it. But, of course, those are points you can bring up and lay it in your case. But, you know, they should and they might. But the thing is, at some point when they realize, look, at you can even pull the police officer in there. Did you show up at the court case? You know, you can make that point. How can they make a ruling if both parties don't show up? And I've seen this done before where the mortgage companies are big on this, credit card companies. Mm-hmm. They won't show up at court and the judge will rule for the other side. Even if you show up, they'll still rule for the other side. And definitely if you don't show up, you're never going to know that the other side didn't show up. And he rules for the other side because they rule for the corporations. But we've got to move on. So
I thank you for that part. I'm first time with that sort of thing. Thank you very much.
Okay, appreciate it. Okay, thanks, Brent. We appreciate it. And Lord willing, we'll see you next Monday. Hopefully you'll stick around and listen in. So
thank
we're going to move over.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. I saw Gerard had fallen off. I don't think he's been back on. Gerard, did you get back on? Are you here? Okay, it doesn't look like he's back in. So I'll take the next question. If anybody wants to get into the queue, star 6 to get into the queue. Crystal from Connecticut, you got a question or a comment?
John?
Yeah.
Can you mute me? My mute's not working.
All right, I'll mute you. There you go. Yeah, it should work with star 6 to toggle back and forth, but okay, Crystal from Connecticut, you've been unmuted. Go right ahead. Crystal from Connecticut, 203. A lot of ones on the end. One more time, Crystal from Connecticut, you've been unmuted. Go right ahead. Looks like you're trying to talk, Chris.
Oh, hi. How are you?
How you doing?
Okay. All righty. Good news. It was on TV today about the illegal foreclosure and one of the congressmen, because we've been contacting and, you know, about the courts and, you know, National Liberty Alliance and learning the constitutional. This Thursday, we're having the disability, and we're having like a luncheon, and there's going to be three things about the illegal foreclosures, you know, learning the constitutional rights, and also for the children, you know, different things. But also, you should be getting a call from this other gentleman who's going to be running for state rep. Connecticut state representative, and he also has a TV show, so he wants you to be on there. I believe he's on this call tonight. I gave him all the numbers. So,
if he wants to get in touch with me, he can reach me at 843-6560.
Hold on 1 second, please. Is that the number? Okay.
845-233-6560. Mm-hmm. Now, I do try to answer that as much as possible, and, sometimes I'm hard to get, so if you mm-hmm. don't get me, try me back 2-3 hours later. Usually you should, because I'm usually here most of the day. So.
And he told me his show live, it's on Friday. I think it's on 8, so I will let you know. I'll have all that information before.
Okay.
But that's what we're trying to do with the...
I'm sure we'll work something out.
Okay. Crystal, we've discussed that with John. We're trying to get it.
Oh, this is the same person.
This is the fellow Bridgeport with a TV program, right?
He's on the phone. There he goes, Charlie. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, we're working that out. I do have the phone number and name of that individual, and I do have to, you know, we're hoping to get on this past Friday, but we've been so bogged down with things, I just never got around to them. So, but yeah, we're interested in doing that. So,
and we also are going to have the TV thing, because it was on our local TV station from here to New York today, you know, about the foreclosures and all that. So,
well, that's good.
I'll speak to you. Yes, it was. I'm so excited about it. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks, Crystal. Appreciate the call.
Okay. Have a good night.
You too. Okay. Let's take our next caller, Ronald from Oregon. You got the mic.
Hi. Thanks for giving me another chance here. I just wanted to comment on the man that was having the administrative problem with the municipal court, and then you pulled through at the very end there, John. I was proud of you. Just challenge the old subject matter jurisdiction, follow the administrative appeal process, and at that point try to straighten out the fact that they need to establish their personal and subject matter jurisdiction. Sounds like that man's in the process of learning there, and he's got your book already. So that's all. That was only. I just wanted to get out there. I didn't want to see that man feeling like he was stranded on the island. And then also, John. For that man, he can Google YouTube, Mark Stevens traffic ticket scam.
Right.
He does a real good job of breaking it down for me, the layman, so that I can go in there and stand up on my own 2 feet.
Right. I appreciate that.
Mark Stevens traffic ticket scam. For everybody being scammed, being mulked out there. And then, hey, there's a great man that we owe a nice word to, and that's Mr. Dan Pilla out of Minnesota. He does the Freedom Calendar, and he's in nearly his 30th year of production, and there's no other calendar like him in the land, and it covers everything in there. It's just an amazing piece of work, and Dan also does what is known as his version of the Money Book, and he actually wrote it for the grade school child, first to fourth grade. So they can begin to learn and interpret the fractional Federal Reserve system.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty amazing.
Okay. Yeah, sounds it. Appreciate it. All right, thank you, Ronald.
All right.
Okay, next call. Let's see, it's a 415 number. Give us your first name and your state.
Jeremiah. California.
From California. You go right ahead, Jeremiah.
Thank you. So I'm asking you a question. Anyone else, you know, Gerard, if he gets on, or Brent can respond. It has to do with the local court rules, local rules of court. It is in reference to some of the teachings, of course, that I have been looking at. And in particular, it gave reference to common law and the local laws that originate with courts. So I guess the question is, are the local rules of court, like say your local county court rules, are those the where you can find the common law rules of the community, the people, you see, that get together and agree how to proceed? Because this reading here that I was on stated that cases that interpret and apply statutes are case law and become precedents, you know, in that jurisdiction, but they are not common law because the legal rule that is being enforced originates with the legislature. So common law rules originate with courts. And I think the reason why it goes on to say that the legislation usually applies to events that will occur sometime in the future, which is not necessarily a common law thing. The circumstances that happen may not always be according to, you know, by the letter of the law, you know, because of the circumstances might be a little bit different. So the statute might not apply, but you still need a remedy. So I was thinking that you could find that, according to this information, in the common law rules that originate with courts.
Well, look, let's get back to the basics and logic and common law, period. You know, it's all about injury and remedy to that injury. I mean, that's what it's all about. And if you're a non-lawyer going into the courts, they got to give you a lot of latitude, okay? Yeah, you know, you should know basic how the procedures and the process works to some degree, and you should understand how to form your paperwork and so on to some degree. But look at bottom line. It doesn't matter how ignorant you are to the whole process. You come in there with your affidavit, and then someone, you know, will give you a form. Well, you got to get an in New York. You got to get an index number, so you got to fill that form out. That's pretty simple, okay? And then you got to pay your filing fee, and there's a little form to fill out for that. That's pretty simple. I usually cross a lot of things out and put in court of record, and they, you know, they don't like that at all, and so on and so forth. But the thing is you're coming in with an affidavit. That's the key. You can write a paper and make your claims, do what's called a verified complaint or a verified. I like to do actions at law, not a verified complaint, because I'm not a complainer. I'm an action person, so I want to come in an action. And complaining, you know, sounds to me like something the slave would do. They're complaining about something. I may be wrong on that thinking, but to me, that's how I see it. But an action. You could do what's called a verified action at law. Okay, you tell your story and you swear to it at the bottom, and then of course you want to still attach a affidavit. You do want a number.
Right. I'm not asking for a remedy. I'm sorry, sir. I apologize for the interruption. I wasn't really asking for a remedy, but instead more of like directions, because in pursuit of finding where we could maybe do some adjusting as a community and with the committee of safety on the local level, I think that through the local court rules, there are some possibilities for contracts and include, you know, and stuff like that too, stuff involving contracts. Because when I searched the local rules for the word contract, it came up 11 times. And the first entry in SF's 2016 edition is at 6.5 D 1 and 2, and it's regarding default judgments in limited jurisdiction cases. And it says requests for default judgments in contract actions and lawful detainer actions must be filed with the court's default unit. Requests for default judgment in contract actions must be by declaration pursuant to CCP's sections blah blah blah.
But when you're talking default, what do you mean by default? I mean, the people don't answer or something, or what are you talking about?
Yeah, that's right. With talking about the unrebutted stuff. So my question is, if we find that we can get a local remedy for our common law situation in the local rules of court, as I just did, right, as to how to proceed with the, you know, the rulemaking agenda. See, because it says here to follow it up, and then you can come on in. It says, however, at the discretion of the court, right, a prove-up hearing may be required. So for people that are looking for that remedy. Okay.
Let's get to simplicity here. Look at, if you file papers and they need to answer and they fail to answer in a specific amount of time, you then file an affidavit of default. Okay, you file it with the clerk. And then you get your paper as far as what needs to be stamped, the file, you know, the file number and the date stamped onto the paper on your affidavit of default. You send a copy to the other side, and then then you can go see the judge, okay? And he has to put a signature there unless there's something.
And let me ask you, reading the rules first, or?
Can I finish? Because not only you, this will help other
yes.
people too.
Yes.
I've done this already. You know, I went in for a default, did it with the clerk, and then I went to the judge just to get his signature so that I can then take it to the sheriff. And you can actually, depending on what it is, if it's very clear, you don't even have to go see the judge, because if you have a good wherefore clause and you're not looking for $20 zillion or something, and it's reasonable, the clerk has certain latitude that they can go forward on, at least they can here in New York. But at certain points in time, they'll tell you still got to go see the judge. In my case, it was quite a bit of money, so I went to see the judge, and I got the final signature for him. And then I just went to the sheriff, gave him the paper, and he took care of the business. And that was that. And, of course, you have to find the money, and if you're seeking money, it depends on what it is that was in your wherefore clauses. So you have to be very clear in the court on what it is you're looking, what your remedy is. And they call that a wherefore clause, so you can put it in a wherefore at the end. But look at let's take it back to simplicity. Affidavit is needed. Swear to everything. And make a very simple document. Call it an action at law. That's what I do. Call it a verified action at law, which means you're swearing to every single thing in that document, and the other side has to answer.
Of course, what you're saying right now is for entertainment purposes, and no one should really apply that unless they read the rules of court.
Well, when you say the rules of court, there's a lot to that. There's the basic general rules of the court in the federal court. There's basic rules on the state courts, and the other courts have their own rules. And even judges make up certain rules. They get a little bit of a latitude. But generally speaking, okay, you don't have to understand any of the rules of the court. If you're not a lawyer, you got a lot of latitude. They're supposed to give you a lot of latitude. You're not expected to know those
right.
things.
Well, let's talk about
those
committee.
Lawyers are expected to know those things.
Committee of safety having an effect on the local rules of court that affect the local community there. When it comes down to process and getting, you know, like a procedure, because certainly, states have a duty to enforce, you know, common law remedies, right? But that's when it comes to statutory provisions and constitutional law. Procedural side, it's a whole nother rule book. Wouldn't you agree?
But you said something about the committees of safety in there. What are you thinking they want to do?
I was thinking that they could have an impact, yes, right? Like, it just got noisy in here, by the way. I was thinking they would be able to get together with local council, city council, and especially the judiciary of whatever municipality. And what you want to do would be, like, talk to them and say, hey, look, this rule right here, this procedure is ultra vires. It's, you know, it's overbroad and
well,
actually
let
it's
me,
futile
let's
because
it.
We'll be
look,
injured.
Look,
we'll be injured.
Look,
that kind of
it.
Stuff. You know what I mean?
Okay, listen. The committee is safe.
Hey, by the way, thank you so much for the call and thanks for taking my call. Okay, you can take the next caller after this.
All right, look at the committees of safety, ultimately, they're not there for remedy of all things. There's a safety problem. There's a situation. Look, we are on the brink of destruction here in America, and that's why it makes the sense to call the committees of safety. It is the committees of safety that worked out the situations to make it safe for the people, ultimately, on the local level, and to try to discern the problem, get resolutions, and try to figure out a solution and get local government to react and respond. We're not in the dire straits that our founding fathers were in back then. We got a different situation. We have a constitution in place. We have the Bill of Rights in place. We have the Declaration of Independence. We still have common law. There's a lot of stuff still going on that's all workable. So what we are trying to teach the committees of safety to do, okay, is really to organize, to get ready, to take control. Ultimately, we just realized this, of the committee man process in the near future by organizing as committees of safety. But the committees of safety job at this point, because we are in extraordinary times, we're in dangerous times, and we have to get the chain of command correct at the local level. If the chain of command, a constitutional chain of command, let me put it that way, if the constitutional chain of command is understood at the local level, that means by the county sheriff and all the local governments, that's the towns, the villages, and the cities, all of the local governments, if they understand the chain of command and the sheriff understands chain of command, and if we can accomplish that in every county, there's nothing that the New World Order can throw at we the people that we can't deal with and take control over. They haven't got a snowball's chance in hell to accomplish anything against the people if we can accomplish that. Because then you have the might and the authority of the entire nation working together on a local level. You see, they're banking on the fact that we're not organized, they're banking on the fact that we're not communicating, and that we're not becoming consistent, and that we're not acting with principles, because they want us to act in chaos, just like they are. But if you can get the principles together, and you can do the right thing, you know, God will likely bless you for doing the right thing. That's just the beginning. But ultimately, after that, we have to organize and we have to be consistent and we have to educate, do all those things. And that's what we're trying to do. The committees of safety should not be doing anything else until they first establish a relationship, a friendship with their sheriff, and the sheriff understands what they're doing, feels comfortable with them, and says, you know, this is the right thing to do, okay? And we educate him in his authority and his power, and then we're doing the same thing with the towns. Once you have the sheriff on your side, now you're going to have the towns going on your side. And again, it is where we're going to accomplish the other side of things is what we're doing here through the grand jury processes, the administrations for the grand jury. When we get to the other side of that, and that, of course, is all going to happen with critical mass, and there's a connection between critical mass and the committees of safety. So you put them together, that the other side of that coin will be to take care of the legal problems and the court problems. But people, look, we need to train our children at a very young age in grammar school, which we spoke about, you know, others spoke about that earlier. We've got to get them in grammar school, and we have to teach them how they need to understand how they themselves, by the time they get out of grammar school, to easily be able to walk into any court and represent themselves. They should know the basic procedures of the court. They should know basically how to write a simple paper and an affidavit and basically how things work. And again, that can only be on the common law side, because it's all really logic and it's all about injury and remedy. That's what the courts are supposed to be for. You get into the contract side, well, then you have to apply the contract to the same situations. You're still looking for injury and remedy. And then you have to go according to the contract. And again, certain things in certain contracts are null and void too. You know, sometimes people stick stupid stuff in there that really can't be held up. I've seen that already, and it makes sense that it's crazy and you can't hold it up. But anyway,
we have more people in the queue. Yeah.
Yes, going to move on. Thanks a lot, Jeremiah. Okay, Larry Little, go right ahead. You got the mic.
This is Larry from South Dakota.
Yes.
I want you to explain the habeas corpus. I did go online and look and see that the habeas corpus that I previously had filed was not currently filed.
Right. We've got, I don't know if you heard the beginning of this, tonight's program.
I've been on all night.
Okay, we did speak about the fact that we got problems with all of the paperwork that's been delivered to us. And your work, you know, we're looking at yours particularly and two or three other individuals who we've been talking to, seeing if we can't piece together what we have on those cases. And I noticed on yours, I think I have a signed affidavit. But I would like to talk with you tomorrow, and maybe we can get your case moving this week. There's two other people also who I'm going to try to make contact with and get going. So there's like three cases, I think.
Okay,
I'll be glad to call you
tomorrow, John.
Hold on. Tomorrow morning is a busy time for me, and then I have a doctor's appointment at 11. So if you call me maybe 1, 2 o'clock Eastern time. Figure that out according to your time, okay?
I'll do that. I'll call you tomorrow. Thank you, John.
Okay. I know you've been waiting a long time, so I appreciate that. Okay, anything else, Larry?
No, that's fine. Okay. I'll take care of it. We'll take care of it tomorrow.
Okay, yeah, I think we'll be able to settle your case and get it filed this week.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, let's go to Frank from California. Go right ahead, Frank.
Yes, hello?
Yes.
Yes, my name is L. Donya Bay. reason being I called not too long ago, some weeks ago. I've been doing the civics course. I had to start over because I had all my belongings stolen, so I'm starting all over again because I know that as taking that course, you have to take notes because the notes are very important. Now, as I was explaining from a couple weeks ago, they sent me to prison for driving with a suspended license, and I put in the appeal as far as because me being a Moorish American, I reclaimed my birthright, and when the incident occurred, they pulled me over. They asked me for a license. I told them I have my rights to travel card. I gave them my reclamation ID. I gave them my tax exempt ID. Then I showed them all my documentations, showing proof that this is what I did as far as documentations on court proceedings of who I am, you know, as far as the religion goes. They slammed me on the ground, said I was a terrorist, said everything was fraudulent. They arrested me for driving with a suspended license. So they ended up sending me to prison for driving with a suspended license because they offered me a plea bargain of about a couple years. Now, this is the second time that I've been to prison for driving. The first time I pled out a couple years for it, I signed the plea bargain agreement, but this go-round I was like, no, I'm not going to sign it at all. I was just coming from work, just as the last time.
Is this a town court?
Excuse me?
Is this a town court, city court, county court?
Yes, state.
Really? State court? What state?
Florida. This is Broward County, Fort Lauderdale.
Okay.
And I put in the appeal. First of all, they sent me to prison for driving. They gave me a year and a day, which from the very beginning they said I'm looking at 10 years, so I better get the plea bargain. But I was like, I'm not going to sign nothing consenting for me to go to prison, and I was just going to work trying to take care of my family. Well, eventually I lost my place. I lost my car. My girl left me. I had custody of my daughter. They took my daughter from me, and they sent me to prison. So now I'm in prison. They want me to work. I said, I'm not working. I said, I didn't do nothing wrong. You know, I'm in a cellmate with rapists, murderers, and everything, and I'm like, I'm here for driver's suspended license. But regardless of the fact, I refused to work while I was in there, so I stayed in the box. I did 9 months at the camp. After 7.5 months, I was in the box. I was trying to go ahead and fight my case due to the people that was in my temple giving me, like, word on how to try to fight it. They wouldn't let the law library people help me out. They wouldn't give me paperwork. I stayed in the box. So eventually I ended up getting a co-counsel because I needed it to try to do something because they was trying to dismiss the case. Initially, I put in a criminal complaint and a writ of discovery and an entry of plea. They dismissed that because they said I couldn't prove that I was indigent. And I was like, I'm in prison. I don't have a job. I don't have anything. How else can I prove that I'm indigent? So they dismissed that. Then they dismissed the appeal. And from while I was in the box, I was doing all type of things, just writing up different motions and seeing that if I can get it reinstated. Well, eventually I did.
Yeah, look, it's obvious that this is vindictive prosecution. So where do you want to go with this?
Well, just now, it was from when in the beginning of March, I spoke to the co-counsel, and the people in my temple was telling me I'm making a mistake. They said, you need to fire this guy because this guy's not going to help you out at all. Well, eventually, when I called him in the beginning of March, he told me call back in September. Now, all of a sudden, I just called him this past, last week, Thursday or Wednesday, I called him. I said, hello, Mr. McIntyre, how the case is going? What's going on? Because it's in the 4th District Court of Appeals. He told me that they dismissed the case. I lost. So I said, oh, wow. So I'm like, when did the judgment come in? He said it was from the end of April. And I said, the end of April? I said, we're in June. I said, well, how come I never got any notification about this? He says, well, I sent the paperwork off to you. I said, I never received anything. So now I say, what address do you have? He given me an address that I first lived in when I was 15 years old. I said, sir, I've sent you my brief, because I did the brief while I was in prison, and I gave it to him, which saying they violated my First Amendment, my Fourth Amendment, my Fifth Amendment, and my 14th Amendment. And he just basically tried to put it in. His words and resent it off. So I'm like, sir, you sent me back a copy of the brief. You sent me the answer brief and all the reply brief. I said, so how is it that now you've given me an address that's when I was 15 years old, that I lived there a long time ago? I said, that's years ago. How you do not have my address now? He said, well, I don't know. That's what they have on file. I said, that's impossible. You've been sending me paperwork at my house right here. So anyway,
all right, well,
no
look
words.
It, look it. Hold uh-huh. on. Hold on a second. Okay. Obviously, this is vindictive. Uh-huh. Obviously, from my impression, okay, because it happens all the time, your lawyer's really working for the court. He's not working for you at all. And he's just not even bothered doing anything for you, probably. So this thing took place in April that they dismissed the case, you're saying?
No. When I called them, I called the courts to actually get clarity. They said the case had been over since the middle of March.
And what was the conclusion of the case?
He said, well, from their brief, they saying that what they did was wrong. They didn't do nothing right. They sent me to prison because I broke the law and I committed a crime. And they dismissed the case.
Okay.
For driving a suspended license.
So they dismissed the case that you already did time for, or they dismissed the case that you were going to file to try to get some remedy on?
they dismissed the case as, no, for the remedy, they dismissed that while I was in prison. They said I couldn't prove
okay,
it.
Okay, yeah, but what was the case? What was who was filing the case?
This was
okay,
the appeal.
So you appealed, and you've already did time on this, and you were appealing that case, and you didn't get anywhere. Look, there's only one thing you could do here. You know, you have to understand how to battle these people, and even understanding how to battle these people doesn't mean you're going to win anyway, because it's an uphill battle no matter what you do. Okay, but what the only remedy or that I think you really have is really to try to work with others to try to save the nation, doing what you can do in your local county, in your town, to do, I would suggest the Committee of Safety stuff, to work with us to try to get us to the point where we can get the critical mass and we can push this back to the other side meaning bringing common law back into the courts, and then people can now come in for the remedy that they couldn't get before and get it taken care of in a common law court where you will get justice. And that's about the best, because at this point you're not in jeopardy of jail, I would say be careful and try to help us to get to the other side so you can get your remedy. Look, it seems to me that these people owe you a lot because of all the pain and suffering you've went through the time you were in jail. What that is worth, you'll have to figure that out, and maybe those are things we'll talk about when we get to the other side. What might
just
be
leave
right?
It, just leave it and let it go. Just leave it alone or something.
No, not just let it go. For right now, there's nothing. You're not going to be able to win it in the court. Okay, you're not going to get a lawyer that's going to be able to battle it because he's just going to work against you, and you'll want to get a lawyer that'll work for a piece of the pie, so to speak, a third. But you're not going to get that because it's a no-win case from their perspective. So you'd have to fight
myself
this,
and continue.
You would have to fight
Supreme
it yourself.
Court.
You would have to fight it yourself, but then you have to understand jurisdiction. You have to understand a lot of different things. You'd have to understand the due process. And if you want, ultimately, this is a federal case. You have to understand how to get it into a federal court. Cause to get it into the federal. It was a federal case?
Yeah, it was in the Fourth District Court of Appeals. It wasn't federal.
Well, I don't know what they call what they're Fourth District Court.
It was
of
in state. They found me guilty, and I appealed it, and they went to the Fourth District Court of Appeals. So it was like more like
But the Fourth District Court of Appeals, I don't think is a federal court.
It's not federal. Oh, okay.
Oh no, because look at it. Down in Florida, I think they've got three district courts, and it would be called the United States. The United States Court for the District of whatever it is, Southern District of New York.
Oh, okay, yeah, no, that one there, that was what I had the criminal complaint and the writ of discovery and everything trying to file for the lawsuit, whatever. And that's the one they dismissed while I was in prison, saying that I did not prove that I'm indigent, and they dismissed
right.
That.
Well, again, it's an uphill battle. I'm listening to your talk. I hear what you've gone through, and you've got some good experience, but you still lack the experience to be able to beat these people. That's clear to me at this point from talking to you. More studying and more, continuing on, you could possibly get to that point where you might have a chance to beat them. But you should continue to study to get to that point. But look, there is no such thing as a statute of limitation in common law. If you've been injured, you can bring this case 20 years from now up and still bring it up. It doesn't matter what they say about their stupid statutes. In common law, there is no statute, so therefore there's no, there's no limit of statutes, of the statutes, statutes of limitations. So, what I'm saying to you is you're going to have to wait till we get to the other side of justice, where justice finally gets into the court. That's what we're battling, and I do believe we're going to get there, and I think sooner than we think, but that's only if the people do respond, because we don't have much time.
Okay.
So that's my thought. Anyway, we're getting close to closing. Matter of fact, we're just about there. I'd like to take one other call before we close off. So.
All right, thank you.
Okay, and just study to get look and take our courses here if you haven't taken our courses.
I'm taking
read
them
our
now.
Book. Yeah, I'm read our book now. On access to the courts, and then work in your own community to get committees of safety. Learn about becoming a committee man. Consider becoming an administrator for the court system. For the grand jury, the trial jury.
Grand jury administrator. Yeah.
Yeah, and get together on that stuff. Let's get to the other side, then you can go and look for your restitution on the other side, because that's where you'll get it. Okay?
All right,
thanks. Okay, one other call. We'll make this quick because we're over time right now. Michael from Colorado, go right ahead.
Yes, John. I was wondering if I could call you tomorrow sometime.
Yeah, do it after 1, 2 o'clock because I'll be out. I'm busy in the morning and I'll be out and should be back 1, 2 o'clock Eastern time. Okay?
Okay, at 845-233-6560.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Okay. All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate it. All right, we've come to the end of the call. I appreciate everyone coming. Please consider getting really active here. Again, please consider donating $5 a month or more. Consider giving something special this month if you can to help us get over the hump. We're way behind, but we're going to go forward anyway with things. We're acting in faith. And Lord willing, we'll see you next Monday also. But again, Thursday, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here in this room, 1 hour for Organizing the Nation. See what about getting there. Okay, good night, everybody. Thank you. God bless.